It's showtime.
Go head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! And here we go, off and running for this 20th day of October 2020. This is the hornheadon.live is where you'll find us on the interweb tubes. That's the best place to go to listen to the program, bar none. It's the best place to listen live. It's the best place to listen in your podcasting needs. It's all right there at headon.live. It's also where we keep the chat room, the merry, wacky, zany, real-time multimedia extravaganza that takes place every evening when this program is live from 5 to 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, 2 to 5 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time, and all time zones in between and the great globe around. And if you wander in right now, well, you'll be met by early arrivers Anatole and Dowhead and Silent R. Lamar and Roger in Oregon and Squeaky, and capably moderated by longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky, who, being a third stage guild navigator, nonetheless has exercised discretion and chosen not to fold space this afternoon because it's 95 degrees there in far northern California with 10 to 20 mile per hour wildfire weather kind of winds. So I certainly understand that. Welcome to Kimmo popping into the room. Looks like we're going to have a good time this evening. This is, of course, Trump-tanic Tuesday, a day for celebrating those moments of right-wing intellect that just scream, all ahead full into that there iceberg, we're going to teach it some manners. Yes. Oh, hi, I'm Bob. And coming up later in the program, along about the beginning of the second hour of the program, I would note, we will be hearing, because it's been rather too long, we'll be hearing from our dear friend, our good friend, another all-around great guy and raconteur and practitioner of culture and observer of things pop. I'm talking about our buddy, Dan Fisher, who will be here in about 57 minutes or so. And we've decided, building on last night's zaniness, because I think that's the only word, zany, merry, wacky, zany, yep, zany. Building on last night's zaniness, we've decided that we need a little more levity and lightheartedness, just to sort of carry us through to November 3rd and beyond. It's the 20th. That means there's 11 days remaining in October. That means we are exactly 14 days away from the end of the election. It is possible we are 14 days from being being done with Nitwit Nero, done with COVID Caligula, done with Trump. God, I hope. I do hope. And I know what you all do as well. But don't want to get ahead of myself, but every program here at the Horn begins with gratitude. And this program is no different. So thanks go out to our 20th day of the month subscribers. That would be thanks very kindly to Reverbo, the human man, to Armand, to Not Billable Rick, to Carl, to Vincent, to Dr. John, and Tina. Thank you, Tina. Thank you one and all for being partial sponsors of the program and helping to make sure this program continues from day to day, week to week, month to month, and yes, decade to decade. We are in the middle of our second decade of broadcasting. We will celebrate our 15th anniversary on Friday. The actual anniversary is on Saturday, but we'll celebrate it on Friday. And that'll be 15 years, 18 years total in terms of the horn, but 15 years as a standalone broadcast enterprise, internet only. And James just helped us get there in a big way. This has been a stressful fundraising month and week. I mean, things just crap piles up. That's all there is to it. And thank you very kindly to James, who did have 2.5 shows on me. So that means today and tomorrow and half of Thursday are taken care of. Thank you very kindly, James. That's tremendous. I cannot thank you enough. You are the program sponsor for Tuesday, prayer meeting Wednesday, and half of Thorn in the Side Thursday. Thank you, James, tremendously. And the community thanks you as well. And thank you as well to Jeremy jumping in first past the post on the evening tonight, this afternoon. Thank you very kindly. And so we are off and running, I suppose, on this Trump-tanic Tuesday. You know, remember, the story of Trump-tanic Tuesday goes back to those heady, halcyon days of broadcasting in America's fifth smallest radio market, Beckley, when the morning right-winger, who has since gone to his long home, announced, answering a question, "Steve, how come it is that there is seashells in the rocks in West Virginia? We ain't nowhere near the beach, and I done seed them when I was down in the coal mines." And he said, "Well, caller, that's because of the movement of the Titanic plates." And it is. It is. It's because of the movement of the Titanic plates. Mm-hmm. Still no word on the Titanic egg scrambler. Nope, not a peep. But that's how Titanic Tuesday came to be, and so it is that we find ourselves looking at some Titanic intellect. Oh, yes, we do. And what better place to examine Titanic intellect than I don't know. How about the Texas? This just made my day when our buddy, our pal, Texas T, posted it just in time for Titanic Tuesday. You remember U.S. representing Chip Roy? Chip Roy from some stream down there in Texas. Dribbling Dick or Chlamydia Creek or somewhere like that down Texas way. He was real offended that he had to sit through some impeachment hearings back toward the end of last year and whatnot, because that Donald Trump, he don't deserve to be impeached. He don't deserve no peaching no whatsoever. And so they had a debate based on, well, a debate for his House seat. Wendy Davis, whose name you may recall, is running against him. And Chip Roy wanted people to understand down there, because it's real important, this is there in Texas politics, because in Texas politics, you don't want none of them, you don't want nobody knowing that you're one of them COVID-19 sissies. One of them people what thinks it's a real disease what won't go away after November 4th. And so when he was a debating of Wendy Davis, Chip Roy there of Syphilis Springs, Texas, Chip Roy he said that he thought everybody should have the herd mentality or immunity. It was his God Emperor Donald Trump that said everybody needed herd mentality. He was talking about herd immunity. And in the debate, with Wendy Davis, he brought up the Great Barrington Declaration. Now, this is a petition that's been signed by all manner of right-wing POSs. It was put out by Libertarian Think, as if libertarians think, a libertarian think tank. And they're real proud of it, because they say they got them 15,000 scientists what done signed the Great Barrington Declaration that says everybody but the most medically frail should get back to living life and build them some herd mentality. I mean, immunity. And I mean, it's got to be taken seriously, don't it? Seeing as how it's signed by 15,000 scientists. Well, the Sky News over to the United Kingdom went to looking for them 15,000 scientists what had done signed the Great Barrington Declaration. And in digging around, the journalists there at Sky News, well, they found a scientist by Dr. I.P. Freely. Dr. I.P. Freely signed the Great Barrington Declaration. And Dr. Person Fake Name signed the Great Barrington Declaration. And Dr. Johnny Bananas signed the Great Barrington Declaration. Then, of course, because it was a wiseacre in the United Kingdom what signed these things, is one of the fellers what signed it was Dr. Harold Shipman. And he might not be so famous over here in the new 90 states of America, the greatest country in the history of the world on earth now, today, forever, in the universe, under God, amen. But he's plenty famous or infamous there in the UK. Mm-hmm. Because he was just he was a GP. He was a doctor. He was a family doctor, but up into the late 1990s. But it turned out he had a hankering to kill people. And so he killed 200 of his patients before he done got caught. And then 18 of the folks there in the Great Barrington Declaration that want them some herd mentality, 18 of them are what you call homeopaths. Now, don't be thinking none of that. It ain't like that. Homeopaths, not homeosexuals. These are people that think that you can heal with, like, crystals and shit. Really, some of them use shit. So there's 18 of them. There's about 100 therapists who signed the Great Barrington Declaration. A bunch of them are massage artists. Yes. Not taking anything away from therapeutic massage, because it can be wonderful. It can be great help. But massage artists are not known for their, shall we say, epidemiological expertise. and some hypnotherapists. They signed the Great Barrington Declaration, too. And it was even signed by a Mongolian throat singer who says that they're a therapeutic sound practitioner. Wendy Davis just after the debate wore Chip Roy there of Gonorrhea Gulch right out, making fun of him for using the Great Barrington Declaration. Because, among other things, it was this past summer when Chip Roy there of Chlamydia Creek, Chip Roy said, and this here's a quote, "On November 4th, there'll be a magic awakening on how we suddenly beat the virus." Really, good luck with all that, Chipper. Spokesperson for Wendy Davis's campaign said, "Congressman Roy's fringe beliefs, coziness with conspiracy theories, and inability to listen to the experts has risked lives and livelihoods. He spent his time during the pandemic downplaying the risk of COVID-19, spreading misinformation, and raising the profile of dangerous fringe conspiracy theories." And all of that is absolutely true. But how do you ignore something like that on Trumptanic Tuesday? That says flank speed into the iceberg like nothing else. Meanwhile, some notes rolling in to begin Trumptanic Tuesday. Barrington Declaration. Bob, I think you mispronounced the Libertarian Outfit's description. It's a libertarian stink tank. Aye, that it is. That it is. That from Tom in sunny San Rafael. Scott in San Diego saying, "I'm surprised, Bob, you neglected to mention my favorite signee to the Great Barrington Declaration, none other than that esteemed lion trainer, Claude Horribly." Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. Richard Smoker. Yeah. All kinds of good fun to be had. Meanwhile, Jeremy in Vermont with the subject line, "wheezing," which I think I've stopped doing about 36 days ago. "Will you start to include fits of coughing and wheezing in your all-too-perfect Rush impressions now that he's announced he has stage 4 lung cancer and treatments aren't going as well as he'd like?" Now, my friends, why would I ever do anything like that? But as Sandra told me a few minutes ago via Twitter, Sandra just said in most simple terms, "Almost time for glory, Rush." Yeah, only I don't think that's any angel, you know. Mm-mm. That ain't angel wings he hears. No. This ain't the end of Vincent Black Lightning. Shotgun blast to his chest, left nothing inside. Come down, Red Molly, to his dying bedside. No, it's not. There's not going to be any angels on aerials or anything like that. Rush is going to hear, if there's any justice to the great beyond at all, Rush will hear nothing but bat wings, because it may not be going too well, and his treatments may not be going as well as he'd like, as Jeremy points out. But, doggone it, they're not going the way most of America would like them to go either. No. And so he's determined to head into that good night telling the same lies and filth that he has made a career out of. My friends!
Look at this headline. commission will mute microphones during final debate between Trump and Biden.
Hold on. Before he, with half his brain tied behind his back, the talent on loan from God, I wish I'd signed on for a longer loan period than margin call. We talked about this last night. It's true. The debate commission is going to mute mics. Now, it sounded for a minute like Kristen Welker would have a red button that she could just go, naughty Trump, and mute him while he continued to scream. But now it appears that it'll be a little bit different. It's just that the other person's mic will be muted in the give two uninterrupted minutes answer portion of the program, which should have been happening all along, unless maybe the folks who set up the first debate there, I assume that since it was Chris Wallace, it was probably a Fox crew that was setting up the technology, unless they wanted that scream fest bullshit. This is not complicated. I do it here from time to time. When we've got a bunch of crosstalk going on Friday on the front porch between, say, the stress line and the Skype group in the old holler tree we sublet from the Keebler Elves, I'll mute one channel or the other while the other one is talking. And that means that we get the ideas across. And, but no. Flush Flimball is outraged, I tell you. Outraged. Yeah.
Look at this headline. Commission will mute microphones during final debate between Trump and Biden. Who do these people think they are? Debate commission will mute the mics? You imagine if they'd have told Abraham Lincoln, we're going to mute the microphone if you don't shut up, sir. Hey, Lincoln would have said, why do you think people are going to be there? To watch you hit the mute button?
No, the mute. Mute button. Well, one, Rush, apparently the therapy may not be working like you wanted, but it's not helping your brain any either. There weren't any microphones when, in the late 1850s, Abraham Lincoln was debating Stephen Douglas. No. And those debates went on. For those, in case you don't know, those debates went on for hours and hours. In fact, that was the hallmark of the day, was the ability of an individual to stand and speak more or less extemporaneously with carefully learned hand gestures and particular enunciations. Mm-hmm. And one of the things in the Lincoln-Douglas debate, you can read about them. There was more than one. The Lincoln-Douglas debates didn't feature them interrupting each other because that was deemed to be most rude. And in fact, if you interrupted, it's entirely possible, being as how it's the 1850s, that the other party would pull out a pistol and shoot you fucking dead. Because that's what America was like back then. Can you imagine if they'd told Abraham Lincoln, hey, we're going to mute the microphone if you don't shut up, sir? Well, Rush, the great muting of the golden EIB microphone is coming soon. And nope. No angels on aerials. Nope. Don't know what the plans are, but my personal preference for the end of Flush Flimball is that he be put in a toxic waste container and that's made to withstand massive amounts of pressure and dropped into the Mariana Trench. because, like, if they were to scatter his ashes or anything, that would constitute, I'm sure, some violation of EPA pollution regulations. Yeah. So that's two Titanic intellects for this Titanic Tuesday, the 20th of October. Lee in New York. Regulations are necessary when people do not behave. When the behavior is not mature, the moderator has got to be the adult in the room. Duh. Steve asking, they muted Abe Lincoln's mic? Is that because they had the debate on the Air Force bases from the Revolutionary War? Yeah, the airports that were attacked by the British during the American Revolution, shortly before the Bowling Green Massacre. You betcha. Meanwhile, Dave number 11, my all-Caucasian basketball team, Ben Dover, Oliver Klossoff, Justin Time, Dick Tate, Harry Pitts, and the sixth man is Les Moore. Yeah. There's actually Justin Case didn't make the squad. Rush meeting Jesus. Steve in New York says, here's the scene at the Pearly Gates, St. Peter. Wait here. The boss wants to meet you. No problem. Hey, I've got my voice back. He's coming, just a minute or two. Who's the short, dark-haired, bearded, swarthy man who looks like Yasser Arafat? That's the boss. Oh, I get jokes. That's the younger brother by another mother. Where's the real blonde-haired, blue-eyed Jesus? No, that's him. Hello, Mr. Limbaugh. Not what you expected, I understand. My friend, obviously you are not the real Jesus and you're having me on. No, sir, we're having you off. Off and far, far away from here. You know, I even put it in the book. Get away from me, ye accursed generation of vipers. And go ye unto the lake of eternal fire that was prepared for the devil and his angels. Oh, but this isn't possible! I assure you, Rusty, it really, really is quite possible. Mm-hmm. And this. Bob! This was the date back in 1973 of the famous Saturday Night Massacre, starring Richard Nixon as Jason, the axe-wielding psycho-president, who tries to hack his way out of the Watergate scandal by firing Archibald Cox, but both Elliot Richardson and William Ruckelshaus resign in protest and refuse to fire Cox. What's that, Giraffe? Giraffe posits the intellectual question, why would a man named Dick attempt to fire a man named Cox? That Giraffe, he wonders a lot of things. I don't know, Giraffe, but we'll have to ask political consultant Jeffrey Toobin about the firing of his Cox, because I think that would constitute a dick out. Oh, my. As it turned out, Attorney General Robert Bork dicked over Cox and fired him, and then Bork got borked because he was a dick upon his failed attempt for a Supreme Court position. As I picked up an Akron Beacon Journal from last week, there was an article about the village of Bay, or better known as Bay Village, Ohio. And many of these people are about as bright as the village people in the Villages, you know, that maggot-infested retirement community in Central Florida, not to be confused with the wonderful rock group The Village People, who have given us such classics as YMCA and Macho Man in the Navy. Hats off to the lead singer of The Village People for telling Trump to stop trying to spell YMCA. Yeah, okay, I'll give you a jingle for that. On the other hand, Bay Village, Ohio, is a well-to-do community just east of Lorain, about 10 miles, and some of its most famous residences include Patricia Heaton from Everybody Loves Raymond fame, Sam Shepard, the doctor upon which the movie The Fugitive was loosely based, and George Steinbrenner, the one-time New York Yankees owner and shipbuilder. Now, I don't think Steinbrenner built the Trump-tanic, but he was busted for an illegal campaign contribution to Richard Nixon. Steinbrenner did build a ship for Nixon, but that ship was sunk by a broken Watergate. It just doesn't stop. However, upon interviewing a local woman from the community who has no stature and obviously lives very modestly, considering she lives on the lower income side of the tracks, the woman stated, "I'm not voting for Biden because he'll raise my taxes." Well, that woman needs to raise her IQ to at least sea level because she does not make $400,000 a year. And that's exactly upon whom Joe Biden is going to raise taxes. Sadly, again, this is the mentality of those who have been borked by watching Fox. Fox is the Cox of news, as their endless lies have dicked people over. What's that, Giraffe? Giraffe says, "Fox has opened the Watergate of lies, deception, and obfuscation as they have flooded at least one-third of this country with total Trump-tanic portions of propaganda." This has been Joey's Journal for Trump-tanic Tuesday, the 20th day of October, with Giraffe headed out to Lake Erie to do some tubing. Well, Giraffe, all I can say is if you're going to go tubing, make sure your camera is muted. That's what got Jeffrey tubing, right? I got a feeling that story's not going to go away for a while. No. One more thing about El Rushbo's final fade-out, Scott in San Diego. "I hope he lives long enough to see Joe Biden and Kamala Harris sworn in on January 20th. Many already suspected that he would shuffle off this mortal coil in sheer terror, screaming his goddamn guts out. Screaming his spleen out. I'm fine with giving him just a little more to shriek about when his microphone is permanently muted. My goodness gracious, we really don't like Flush Flimball, do we? No, no. As to the Great Barrington Declaration, Brother Deacon Asa says, "Damn, Bob! Signed by 1,500 quacks, ne'er-do-wells, former murderers, and other sundries? Jesus! The Great Barrington Declaration sounds like the epidemiological equivalent of voting third party to burn it all down! You know, even the lotus has to rise from the mud." Hey, congratulations to Steve from North Carolina. Subject line: voted. "My wife and I went out and early voted here in North Carolina yesterday. Only a 30-minute wait for our local polling place. My non-political wife, well before Trump voted for the first time, heard her friends can't wait until he's gone." Well, she may be non-political, but she is plenty intellectual, sounds like. So, good on you, Steve, and Mrs. Steve. That's two more, and they say that North Carolina is too close to call right now. Steve, maybe you could tell me how much of an impact is the so-called sex scandal having in the Senate race there as Thom Tillis tries desperately to hang on to his seat. Are North Carolinians that hung up about sex scandals, seeing as how the President of the United States has been credibly accused of actual rape by north of 20 actual women, and that was a consensual case of adultery and fornication? Just curious. yesterday evening, I mentioned briefly that I was bummed out to see that the Braves choked. Well, that does not extend to everybody in the Horn Family Community Congregation. I got a communication from Rico. Subject line: the Braves. They had 14 straight division titles from 1992 on and only won one World Series title in that period, despite having many perennial All-Stars and future Hall of Famers. They are the embodiment of one of the biggest choke franchises of all time. And yes, my opinion is colored by the fact that they beat my Pirates in 1992 in the most heartbreaking loss I've experienced as a sports fan. Though I have no love for the Dodgers, I'm so glad they beat the Devil Braves. Yours in bitterness forever, Rico in DeBerg. Yeah, that was, and you know what? There was some karma involved in that in 1992 because they beat the Pirates heartbreakingly. And then they themselves lost a nail-biter heartbreaker in the seventh game to, was that the year they played the Twins? Yeah. Ugh. What a World Series that was. Let's see here. I disagree, says Steve in New York. I'm going to assume the position of ray of fucking sunshine, but remember this, and we must remember that if he loses the election, the real hell will be until January 20th, 2021. If we thought the last 4 years was bad, he will pack 10 times the crazy and destructive into those 11 weeks than he has in the last 4 years. We will need to buckle up. The only thing that keeps me from thinking there may not be violence is that the Trumpanzees are such fundamentally cowardly creatures that they will cower in their bunkers. Yeah, but today, Agnes had a doctor's appointment, and flu shot time and all of that. And as I sat in traffic, I snapped a quick picture of the vehicle in front of me that had a giant decal of the Roman numeral 3, III, surrounded by stars. This is the logo of the Three Percenters. That's the domestic terrorist organization that claims that it will be the shock troops for Donald Trump. And they have infiltrated, between them and the Oath Keepers, they have infiltrated the military, they have infiltrated law enforcement, and they are out there in the general community. Some will huddle in their bunkers. Others, however, well, others will not be quite so calm, because you might be surprised to know that there are actually no, in a number of jurisdictions, there are no laws against bringing your gun to the polling place. Really and for true. Yeah. And, the Braves, Angelo pointing out, they lost in 1993 to the Toronto Blue Jays. They also lost to the Minnesota Twins in 1987. Yeah, we'll get all the we'll get the timeline sorted out. Lee in New York says, "I'm sick of these cheap people who cannot understand that you pay taxes to get stuff. Get your government hands off my Medicare. They love the military. They think that gets paid for with bake sales. Well, they're not the sharpest spoons in the chandelier. Oh no." So, that gets us through most of the emails and a couple of early Trumptanic Tuesday stories. But there are a couple that I wanted to also take note of. You know, the country is, and probably experiencing it to one degree or another, anybody who isn't one of Trump's billionaire pals is experiencing it. The economic fallout of this godforsaken dondemic. It is real and it's painful. Millions of people are at risk of losing their homes, losing everything as the economic consequences of the dondemic play out and are largely ignored, especially by the Republican Party. And in particular, hanging on to power is Chinless Mitch McConnell, Moscow Mitch, who, according to a report today in the Washington Post, McConnell is arm-twisting inside his caucus, his Senate Republican caucus, saying, "Now, don't you dare be thinking about doing no stimulus plan before Election Day. Them layabouts and lazy Americans that ain't married to a lame child like I am need to go fuck themselves for a while. 'Cause Nancy Pelosi, she ain't negotiating with Steve Mnuchin in good faith. Which is another way of saying she ain't telling Steve Mnuchin to fuck right off and that they ain't going to be no stimulus before Election Day, because this was the drop-dead day, apparently, according to Nancy Pelosi, for the time it would take to get legislation through the House, through the Senate, and onto the president's desk for signature. And even if that was happened before Election Day, there won't be any checks before Election Day. So for all intents and purposes, Chinless Mitch has shit on the notion of doing anything for the American people for the next 2 weeks. He wants to use the threat of, or the promise of later stimulus, skinny though his idea of it was, he wants to use that to try to arm twist America into fucking itself for 4 more years. My God. I mean, we know that Trump is stupid and crazy and avaricious and petty and venal and jealous and ignorant and any number of other adjectives. But my God, is there anyone as truly down on the ground evil as Mitch McConnell? I mean, I can't get over the fact that a kid who came near to dying from polio and was only saved by liberalism would grow up and be as awful and shitty and miserable and terrible and horrible and no good and rotten, and the best part of him ran down his mama's leg, as Mitch McConnell is. But here we are, and there he is. And the reason he doesn't want any stimulus considered by the Senate? Well, any deal that Nancy Pelosi and Steve Mnuchin make, any deal they make might disrupt our plans to confirm Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court next week. Because, man, they can't get that done fast enough. And for good reason. Because we discussed, as it being good news yesterday evening, the fact that the Supreme Court had rejected a Pennsylvania Republican and maggot suit to try to throw out ballots that might arrive late. The Supreme Court of Pennsylvania had already considered the issue, being the court of last resort inside the state of Pennsylvania. And so, using appropriate rules of construction and interpretation, the three so-called liberals on the Supreme Court, Elena Kagan, Sonia Sotomayor, and Justice Breyer, well, they came to the conclusion that it is absolutely the right of the state of Pennsylvania's Supreme Court to pass upon the constitutionality and correctness of a law passed by the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And so those three, plus old Balls and Strikes Roberts, said, nope, Republicans, we're not going to throw out any damn ballots in Pennsylvania. And that was the good news, right? But there's always a little ray of sunshine in here. The reason that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruling stood is because it wound up a 4-4 tie. since there was not a ninth member on the Supreme Court, there was no majority. Had Amy Coney Barrett been there, God alone knows how many ballots would be thrown out in Pennsylvania. And if, in fact, Chinless Mitch McConnell can get that jurisprudential incompetent onto the court, the Republicans will try to get that very same suit back into the Supreme Court and have it ruled upon and get a nice 5-4 majority to throw ballots out that will include Amy Coney's parrot, who will not be behaving in a very originalist fashion when she votes that way either. And it won't be terribly textualist either. Because this is one of those moments when we recognize that we have 50 plus territories, 50 petty fiefdoms called states. And each one of those states runs the elections as they see fit, especially since John Roberts declared that there was no racism in America anymore and that the Voting Rights Act should be gutted. So, no stimulus. Because it's more important to Mitch McConnell, it's more important to get Amy Coney's parrot onto the court than it is for people to eat and keep living. Dangerous, perilous times. But what I was getting at is these 50 petty fiefdoms have 50 Supreme Courts that declare what their state law is. And you're not very originalist at all, and certainly not textualist, if you're willing to impose your judicial activist views on a case in which you have no business appearing. So there's that. Our buddy Lou, in PA, says, "Go Dodgers!" Well, I mean, I'll be rooting for the Dodgers. I will. The way I was raised, you root for your team, and then if your team doesn't win, you root for the National League in the World Series, and that's how I'm a National League guy. Lou says, "I agree with your listener that we will have Trump doing tremendous damage directly and indirectly until mid-January. I predict we will have gajillions of his lawsuits as well as his rallies and tweets well beyond January 20th. I predict we will see Trump running for president in 2024 as well. I suppose that's a possibility, but the goddess of irony may have other plans, and I hope she does." Lou says, specifically on the topic that I was just talking about, "I assume you're aware of his recent lawsuit vis-a-vis Pennsylvania balloting. From the New York Times, the Supreme Court's decision yesterday on absentee ballots in Pennsylvania offered a preview of how the court may rule on the raft of voting rights cases that are bound to show up on its docket. As Republicans seek to limit voting amid the pandemic. In a split decision, the justices let stand a ruling by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court that will allow the state to count absentee ballots received up to 3 days after Election Day. Republicans had challenged Pennsylvania officials' plan to count ballots after November 3rd as long as they were mailed by that date, but the state court upheld it. Chief Justice John Roberts yesterday joined the liberal wing, as I described, which is now down to 3 members after the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in rejecting Republicans' request for a stay on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's ruling. The justices' deadlocked ruling, with the 4 conservative justices besides Roberts united in support of Republicans' request to limit voting, suggests that Judge Amy Coney Barrett may play a decisive role in deciding any post-election legal cases if the Senate confirms her to the court this month, as it is expected to do. A number of voting-related lawsuits in Pennsylvania remain undecided, including whether election officials will have to perform signature matching on absentee ballots. Because, you know, nobody's signature ever changes over time. Ever. Nope. My signature is exactly the same as it was when they taught me cursive writing and 3rd grade, and it's, yep, never changed. Not an iota. Subject line: McConnell, Jack in Shreveport. It says, "I really hesitate to use the word evil to describe a person or a thing, because it feels like it's playing to religious nuttery. But McConnell, if anyone does, deserves being described by the term. Yeah, I'm kind of the same way, but sometimes, you know, if the shoe fits. Exactly. Thanks, Jack. My take on the Senate race here in North Carolina, Steve in North Carolina says, is that the sexting scandal has had little to no effect on the race. Some of the polls show that Cal gained some support through it. My personal opinion is Cal can sext whoever he wants to as long as he supports pre-existing conditions and public option. My wife is a thyroid cancer survivor, so we're big on health care. I can understand that. Our daughter is as well, Steve. And she's got to be able to continue seeing the doctor. Like ever so many tens of millions of people in this country whose health care is at risk as of November the 10th. Once Amy Toney's parrot gets her handmade ass onto the court. And so Darlene pointing out, oh my God, Mitch McConnell's a fucking asshole. Ah! Yeah, yep. And sends along this story. U.S. Senate to vote Monday on Amy Coney Barrett nomination to Supreme Court. At a press conference, Chinless Mitch said, "We'll be voting to confirm Justice to be Barrett next Monday. I think that will be another signature accomplishment in our effort to put on the courts, the federal courts, men and women who are shameless lick spittles to the Federalist Society and don't have a compunction in the world against fucking over the American people." No, he said, "Men and women who believe in the quaint notion that maybe the job of a judge is to actually follow the law." Well, then following the law, then why did those four judges, you know, Clarence Pubes on the Coke can, Slappy Thomas, and Sammy Bad Breath Alito, you know, Sammy shoot the black kid in the back of the head at 30 yards, even though he's running away and doesn't have a weapon, Alito. And Ann's boy, Neil Gorsuch, and, of course, Brat Kavanaugh, who likes beer. Why did they vote to take away the decisional power of the Supreme Court of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania if they're just going to follow the law? So what? How did I miss this? How did? When did they vote her out of committee? Ah, there it is. The Republican Majority Senate Judiciary Committee is expected to approve her nomination this Friday, sending it to the full Senate for a vote, which McConnell said will happen on Monday. Do you realize what that means for how much debate there will be about her nomination? Not even a day. Not even a full working day. Not even the equivalent of the day that's worked by the guy in the pit at Jiffy Lube. Not even a full working day for the stock clerk at Walmart. Not even a full work day for 47, maybe 49 senators who do not want her confirmed. And of course, Nitwit Nero's made it abundantly clear that he wants her there because he needs her there, because he intends to muck everything up with one lawsuit after another as he tries to create chaos in the aftermath of the election, which ends November 3rd. So we are to make reference to that ancient Chinese curse. We are living in interesting times. That's true. Megan pointing out Amy Tony's parrot. Well, she once decided a prison guard wasn't guilty of raping an inmate because rape wasn't in his job description and didn't think using that word that's got all the same letters as ginger but isn't ginger, didn't think that rose to the level of a toxic work environment. What could possibly go wrong, Megan asks. Say, how does overturning pre-existing conditions square with the millions of people who got COVID and didn't die? Asking for a friend. Yeah. Won't that just be fascinating? And just because it is Trump-tanic Tuesday and it doesn't really want to wait until prayer meeting Wednesday, I've got a clip just to wrap up the hour with a little bit of merry, wacky zaniness that'll carry us handily into our conversation with Dan Fisher coming up in short order. I don't know about you, but I live for a good Pat Robertson clip. You know, former liquor supply officer Marion Robertson. You can't make this stuff up.
Well, here goes. I want to share with you, I was praying on Sunday saying, God, please tell me how it's going to happen. And I hope I've got the word. But first of all,
Let's see here.
I want to say without question, Trump is going to win the election. That doesn't mean you sit home and don't vote. That means you get out and do everything you can to work. But he's going to win. That's, I think, a given. But after he is sworn in and his vice president is Mike Pence, then... trouble is going to happen. He's going to be challenged by the Chinese, as you couldn't believe. He'll be faced probably with some kind of a war. The North Koreans are going to have nuclear weapons. They're going to threaten us. The Russians are going to do everything they can. The Turks have got their things going. And after Trump is sworn in, we're going to see civic disobedience in our America that will just be mind-boggling. The country will be torn apart. But you talk about Trump derangement syndrome, it's going to be horrible. Because already, without anything happening, we've got trouble in the streets. But there will be at least two attempts on the president's life. And it's going to be very difficult. So I would just urge you, if you should pray for him. But now, in the process...
Now, the two attempts on his life, does that include COVID? Just trying to keep the math squared up here. And there's going to be violence in the streets by the people who don't run around carrying guns, while the maggots, you know, do. He's pulling out all the stops. Marion is here. Trying to get Emery and Marveline sitting there in their matching Barca loungers all worked up. Now, don't stay home. You got to go out and go vote. It may be the last thing Emery and Marveline do. But neither Marion, the former liquor supply officer Marion Robertson, nor Donald Trump much cares about that part of it. No, hell no. But, hey, there's good news. After all of this, that's... then there's going to be a thousand years of peace or something.
The process that this confusion is happening in America, and it looks like our country is being torn apart, the fulfillment will take place of Ezekiel 38's prophecy. And here's what it says. It says, therefore, son of man, prophesy and say to Gog, this is what the sovereign Lord says, in that day, when my people Israel are living in safety, will you not take notice of it?
Well, that's clear.
and you will come from your place to the far north, and many nations with you, all of them riding on horses, a great horde, a mighty army. You'll advance against my people, Israel, like a cloud that covers the land. In days to come, Gog, I will bring you against my land, that the nations may know me when I am proved holy through you before their eyes. Now, that's going to be next. You're going to have Trump win. You're going to have civic discourse.
Horses?
You're going to have at least two attempts on the life of the president. And, you know, you just pray as to what's going to happen in relation to that. But this country is going to be torn apart. And it will be the opportunity for Erdogan and Iran to come together against Israel. And that's what Ezekiel says is going to happen, that there's going to be.
Now, let's remember, Ezekiel was a dude who lived, about 2,600 years ago, who didn't understand shoelaces or wheelbarrows or why it rained or what those big bones sticking out of the dirt were. No, those were the bones of the giants who wandered the land before Noah got the. And before the humans got the planet all flooded up and everything. Yeah, Gog, and everybody's going to be riding horses. And, you know, I'd think that shouldn't be much of a challenge for Israel. I mean, being how they're all the Gogites are going to be on horses. I think you can probably, as say, 1939 proved, you can wipe out a lot of horses because, remember, the Polish cavalry, nobility and brave and noble, rode out on their horses against multiple Panzergruppen, and the horses didn't fare too well against the tanks. So I'm guessing all those horses coming out of the north aren't going to fare too well against, American-made super-duper high-tech fighter aircraft with bombs and missiles and ray guns and laser beams and frisbees and wheat checks and shit, but then Pat lets us know we're going to have several years of peace and global revival, and then the world will experience the end times, great tribulation, when an asteroid strikes the earth. I won't be around for that, I guess, unless they bring me back. Asteroids, Earth is either going to suffer an asteroid or hemorrhoids. God wasn't real clear about that. Ow. You know, they burn. They do. Nothing in the Bible about asteroids. But then again, former liquor supply officer Marion Robertson. Isn't it interesting? We were talking about him just last night in the Edgar Cayce Institute there in Virginia Beach. And lo and behold, here he is today. God, we're like magic. That reminds me, speaking of magic, there's no greater magic to be had here on the Horn than when our buddy Dan Fisher and I get together for some good conversation, and Dan's with us now. Hey, Dan.
No, you've made a mistake.
I have?
This is actually Mr. You Pinch Me. My first name's Haywood.
Yeah, Haywood. Haywood, you pinch me.
Yes. Yes.
I know that you pinch me as well.
You know, you got to go with one from The Simpsons, Moe's Tavern, and that was one of the more family friendly of the ones I could have.
And the sisters, and they really did exist back in the 19th century, maybe up into the 20th. The sisters, I'm a hog and you're a hog.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I'm sure they're on the Great Barrington Declaration, too.
Would you think that Ms. Huggenkiss also, Amanda, you know, because yep. We need Amanda Huggenkiss.
Absolutely.
You know, sign that Barrington Declaration.
And then there's Amanda B. Reckoned With. She likes to use that. She likes to use that middle initial.
Amanda, yeah. The light of my life, according to Waylon Jennings, way back. Anyway, how the hell are you? It's been a while since I've been here.
I'm okay. How the hell are you? I worry more about you. You know, you being kind of immunocompromised in the middle of a fucking pandemic and whatnot. Oh, we're off throwing the F-bombs around. Sorry, Dan.
You've been, yeah, wow, I was really impressed. Well, first of all, I listened to this show tonight from 5 o'clock because I'm working from home, so I have that luxury right now. I can just turn on the horn at 5, and there's nobody to complain about it because this is little old me working in my room, sitting on my bed. So yeah, I got to hear your plentiful use of the F word. Of which I may indulge here and there, I imagine, within the next 2 hours. And I got to hear your impressions. I was very impressed by your impressions, you know.
Well, thank you.
You know, John Biner, you know, Rich Little. Well, I don't know if they're both dead. I know Rich is. Biner is. Anyway, you're not there yet, but you're easing up on them. We haven't had a good impressionist comedian for a while. You know, it used to be sort of a staple of showbiz, right? You had Sullivan Show and everything. There was always some person to come out and go, you know, if James Cagney worked at the big boy, it might sound something like this, you know. And you know, whatever. I can't do James Cagney. I can't do impressions. Not like you do with your Southern preachers and your one-lunged Rush Limbaugh and what have you.
One-lunged Rush.
One-lung Rush, they call him. You know, he's going to be Russian.
Well, speaking of which, I do have a little announcement to make at the beginning of our conversation that I think you'll enjoy and others will as well.
Sure.
You know, it was in your very first appearance on this program that you identified that essential quality that attends this broadcast. And that is the fact that I am an entirely adequate radio host.
Yes, you are. Adequate.
Adequate. Well, that adequacy has been recognized. I received an email today telling me, I got an internet today. You know, it's not a big truck. It's a series of tubes. I got an internet today from the folks at WV Living magazine. And I am the second runner-up best media personality in West Virginia.
Well, that's almost great. That's adequately...
That's thorough. Isn't that just delightfully adequate?
That is as adequate as one could be second runner-up. I mean, it's better than a participation trophy, I suppose. Yeah,
absolutely.
We liberals...
It means that I can't just take out the winner. I got to get the first runner-up, too.
Yeah, well, maybe there's a sex scandal or something, some nude photos in their past. I voted for you, by the way.
I know you did. That's why I told you.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you campaigned. You campaigned hard. You stayed clean. You know, I didn't watch the debate. Who was the winner, do you know?
I do not. I think they refrained from telling me that, lest I take action. And it turned in. Are you familiar with that classic Alec Guinness comedy, Kind Hearts and Coronets?
I'm familiar. I've not seen that one. I just recently saw The Lavender Hill Gang, but I've not seen Kind Hearts and Coronets.
The plot of Kind Hearts and Coronets is that there is a young, distant heir to the throne, or some noble peerage or something, and he's he has to knock off like 13 people. To get to the inheritance, and Alec Guinness plays all of his victims.
Right, I know that much. He was in multiple roles. I'm losing audio on you all of a sudden.
No, you're not. You're not. You should be good. You hear me?
Well, I was hearing you, but you were cutting out, and it was like Alec Guinness.
That could be what we call internet weather.
No, I see. So maybe it's not me, it's you. I don't know. But so, tell me more about Alec Guinness, Uncle Bob. Wasn't he the Star Wars guy?
Yes, and he was also Prince Faisal in Lawrence of Arabia, which I think is it's my favorite role of his.
It's a little out of fashion now to embrace the old brown face stuff. You know, I used to love Peter Sellers in The Party, but over the years I've kind of tamped down that love.
But he's not playing brown face. Those white folks.
Faisal?
Oh yeah.
What? playing a white Arabian guy, huh? I mean, I've seen Lawrence of Arabia. Didn't he put on a little of the Trump shade, more in the burnt umber skincare regimen?
Well, he looks a lot paler than Omar Sharif.
Okay. Anyway, maybe it's funny. I thought Faisal was. I thought he brown faced. But it's been a while. Last time I saw, I haven't seen it in like 20 something years. When it came out, they did like a theatrical re-release in I think the 90s or so. I think back when I was a single person and could actually like just go to the movies whenever the hell I wanted, because who was gonna, you know, decide I.
Well, for me it was just the delivery of the lines, because David Lean was ahead of his time, and he has Faisal say to Lawrence, "I suspect you're another of those desert-loving Englishmen."
Mm.
A lot of truth in that, you know, English colonialism and whatnot.
You know, yeah. That's another thing too. I've heard some critics who are actually more left-wing than I, you know, basically condemn Lawrence of Arabia because it's a celebration of colonialism, blah, 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 which I don't think it's a celebration. I think it's, you know, it's the same way as I watch. And it's not, you know, that's not a celebration of colonialism. That's showing that it's complete madness and you know, wrongheaded to go into the Amazon jungle with when you're wearing full armor and no familiarity with the territory. I believe that God is on the side.
It's amazing what happens when, you know, people get full of themselves like that. Ron in Raleigh wants you to know that John Boehner is still above the ground. And he is...
Oh, good.
Yeah, he's 82. 82, so...
God bless him. I mean, really, he's... I don't know who else, you know, from that generation of you know, like Von Meter, you know, died actually very tragically... You know, because when Kennedy was assassinated, Von Meter's career was over like that. And then Frank Gorshin, I believe, is long gone. Jim Carrey actually does a lot of great impressions. Not that I'm a fan of his Saturday Night Live Biden stuff. I think he's too fireman.
Yeah, I think you're right. I thought Woody Harrelson made a much better Biden.
I haven't seen Woody Harrelson's Biden. You know, I watch Saturday Night Live the way a lot of people do now. I'll just sort of pick out the YouTube clips that look interesting, and I'll watch those. And you know what? I'm actually watching right now old Saturday Night Lives. Like I'm going through season two on Peacock, and it's really pretty stunning. The difference they're very two very different shows. First of all, now you've got literally 20 people in the Saturday Night Live cast. So I don't know who half of these people are, literally, right. I don't know. Yeah. And it takes away the fun element, like when there were only seven.
Well, right. I mean, one of the good examples of the difference is that whoever hosts Weekend Update, that's all they do.
Yeah.
Whereas Weekend Update started out Chevy Chase, then it was Dan Aykroyd and
Kurt came after Chet.
Jane Curtin.
Then Danny and Chevy, and then I don't know after that. I think that's when they went into the other era.
The people who did Weekend Update also did the sketch comedy.
That's right. Although I don't think later on, like Dennis Miller, I don't think he did a lot of sketches. And some of the other guys, who was that? Who's Norm?
McDonald.
What's his name? Norm McDonald. He did like Bob Dole and a couple others. But you're right. Yeah. I mean, but that was the fun of that show back then, was the danger of, you know, they were just like get from one costume to the other, take off a beard, you know, jump into the next sketch. And that was fun. And now I'm going to sound like Grandpa Simpson here. But, you know, now it's not nearly as dangerous because you have 20 people in the cast and half of the show now is film segments. So it's a little easier, and you have skits that are now like 15 minutes long. So you don't have to worry about like fulfilling 20 slots. You just have to fill like six slots, and you're good for the hour and a half. But I don't know. What were we talking about again? Oh, yeah, Biden and everything and impressionists.
Yeah, right.
I'm going to wander a lot, I have the feeling.
That's okay. We've got an hour and 45 minutes worth of wandering, and I think it's going to be a wonderful little wander fest.
Yeah, well, like it's like you were saying at the top of the show, and you and I had discussed it over the weekend. You know, it's just been such a shit show. You know, I don't have to tell you that. We need I just figured, you know, now is a good time for me to come back to your show and just, you know, have some fun, you know, on the air. You know, just chat with you and see where we go with things and try to have some laughs and try to give the listeners some laughs. And if we bring up like a movie or a TV show that, you know, strikes a chord, you know, please, you know, comment, you know, email, whatever you guys do these days, text in. And let's all just sort of share that because, you know, we've done a lot of heavy lifting in the past, you know, since 2016, certainly. And we're doing a lot of heavy lifting in this year in particular. And it would be just nice to every once in a while remember that, you know, life is to be enjoyed, too, not just taken on as a burden. And so let's dare to be a little bit trivial tonight. Let's dare to be silly and go on tangents. And I'm going to just ram through these run-on sentences as long as I can.
Absolutely. And by the way, Ron lets us know Rich Little is also still among the quick.
Oh, my God. Really?
And he's actually a year younger than John Boehner. He's 81. Frank Gorshin went to his long home in 2005.
Okay. Well, let's just say then that I've not come on here tonight to be a fountain of information. Because so far I'm 0 for 2 in the Jeopardy category of dead impressionists.
But you did mention you're back to work, even though you're working from home.
Yeah, I
am. What's going on in your world?
Well, we finally came back after a hiatus from March to August. How many months is that? At least 4, right? So I started a TV show. I started working on a TV show for Apple TV in August of 2019. And it's an epic science fiction show that I can't share too many details about because I did sign a confidentiality agreement. But I would reckon in I don't know how many months from now you'll hear about it because it's a big special effects extravaganza. Lots of action, lots of explosions. I will say there's space aliens involved, and we started it. Like I said, I started in August 2019, and we were still going on season one when we shut down in March. So we came back in August, and we will finally finish shooting season one on November 4th, the day after the election. We'll have finished shooting this day.
So once you stop shooting, how long does the post-production take before it hits air?
Well, in normal times, it takes, it depends on things. It takes at least a month or two, but these are not normal times, you know? And the way we were shooting the show, we're sort of, because it's so logistically difficult, I will say, too, that this show, we have filming units going on around the globe. We've got a unit shooting in London, another one in Tokyo, another one in Morocco. So just putting all those elements together, and I don't know how they're doing on their schedules. I really couldn't tell you when this one will come out, but I do know that it costs.
Well, I'm always game for a new space opera. Without asking you to violate any of the terms of your contract, which I know you would not do anyway, but can you tell us, is it based on a book or is it brand new, fresh material?
It's fresh material. It's all original. We have a working title that I don't think will last, but I'm not even going to say that because something's telling me. I think that it's going to be big news because, you know, I worked on another Apple TV show about Emily Dickinson, and that's actually done very well. Like, my daughter likes the show because it's Emily Dickinson but with a hip-hop vibe with, like, Wiz Khalifa playing Death, and that's an interesting show. But this one is going to be like, hey, everybody, you know, this is the thing. You know, Apple's not messing around here. You want You want lots of CGI. You want, like, you know, Avengers level action and explosions and stunts. You're going to get it. Here it is. So I think it's going to be fun. It's not going to be, you know, like watching Ingmar Bergman. You're not going to necessarily come out of it an enlightened soul. You're not going to look at your wife any differently having watched this show. But on the other hand, it seems to me like it's going to be a nice, fun Saturday night on the couch, popcorn, science fiction thriller.
Awesome.
Yeah. I didn't mean to come on and plug my stuff.
I want you to, because one of the things that I think goes hand in hand with the fatigue that attends this Dondemic is we've watched, it's amazing. I think most of America thinks it has now watched every movie made from Sergei Eisenstadt forward.
Pretty much. Well, it's funny though, right? I mean, because I think I hear now that there's something of like Netflix fatigue, or where people are feeling like they've basically watched everything that there is worth watching on Netflix or Amazon or what have you. It's not true, but I can't tell you how many times people, like, even, you know, I will just go through the Netflix list and I'll just browse for like 20 minutes before just giving up.
Yeah, Agnes and I sit there in the bed at the end of the day, got Netflix open, got Amazon Prime open, scroll, no, maybe, nah, no.
Right.
I was lucky in that I recalled a recommendation that a friend of mine had given me. So the other night, we were, and I mean, I'm not trying to in any way diminish the quality of the program. It's just that it's not the kind of thing that I'm going to go click, you know, I'm on it. We got to the point where I clicked My Octopus Teacher, and we watched that for an hour and a half or so.
My Octopus Teacher.
Yes, a documentary about a man and his octopus.
I was thinking that could go a number of ways. I was imagining like the Pixar-type version, like a low-rent Pixar knockoff called My Octopus Teacher. I was also thinking something a little more corny, frankly. But you're talking a documentary.
Yeah, it's a documentary. A guy having some sort of midlife crisis down on the Cape in South Africa. And he goes snorkeling through the kelp forest there by the coast and has a relationship with an octopus.
Uh-huh. Are they the same religion? Are there problems with that?
Well, that is only the beginning. It's a very kind of a Zen thing, and he's trying to sort himself out, and halfway through, about two-thirds of the way through it, Agnes got really mad at him because I don't want to spoil anything, but there's some real action in it, and it's kind of uplifting, but it's also kind of sad.
The octopus dies. Is this a Monkey and Me kind of moment? Octi and Me.
Yeah, I mean, they only live for a year and a half, and he went swimming with the octopus every day for a year and then showed how it all came to an end. And but yeah, we got to the point where we watched My Octopus Teacher, and of course, because you mentioned it, we started working our way through Columbo.
Columbo, yes.
And
I mean, it's something, you know, I watched all of season one, and I kind of burn out on it. I want to come back to it, but it is a little 1970s, you know, and some
wow,
stuff.
Is it?
Yeah, but on the other hand, I mean the writing is fun and great, and Peter Falk is just he is a living, well, he's no longer living. This much I know: Peter Falk is dead. Nobody contradict me, smart asses. I know he's dead, but he was at one time a living treasure. And will always be a treasure.
And an actor's actor.
An actor's actor. I think I told you, I tried to watch this John Cassavetes movie called A Woman Under the Influence, and he's great, and Jenna Rollins is, oh my God, she's incredible. But it was so painful. I couldn't take the psychic pain. I got halfway through it. I'm like, you know, I've watched a lot of painful movies that a lot of people wouldn't watch. You know, but it was just so deeply personal and hurtful. I had to turn it off.
But some of those things are like old friends. I think it was episode 3 of the first season. I looked up and went, Jesus Christ, that's Ray Milland.
Yeah. Yeah. Ray Milland in the first season, he's fantastic in one of the early episodes. And he comes back for season 2 and he's kind of like, it's kind of a badly written role and he just hams it up. But there's a lot of great people like that. There's Irene Dunne shows up, you know. And then you get people like, I love Roddy McDowell. I mean, I'll watch Roddy McDowell in anything, you know.
Jack Cassidy, just smarmy and groovy and sleazy.
Best. He's the best.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you know, you gotta hand, what's his name? Oh, God, I'm blanking on it. Bobby, the guy was in Bob and Ted and Carol and Alice.
Robert Culp.
Robert Culp, another fantastic Columbo villain. But if I got to choose one, I'm going Jack Cassidy. Lee Grant was a good villain, too. One of the early women.
You know what? Speaking of having watched everything, I was reading the bio on Lee Grant. And I need just to check in on the 70s kitsch of it, because I remember it was, as a kid, I remember it caused such a stir for some reason or another. She won Best Supporting Actress for Shampoo in 1975.
And that's correct.
I need to go and watch that movie. I've never actually seen it.
Oh, you haven't?
No.
I mean, I'm sure that there's politically incorrect things in there, etc. But my memory of it, it's just a fantastic, sexy sex comedy. And funny, and it's Hal Ashby. So, you know, he directed that.
Yeah.
And it's just brilliant. And it's the kind of movie they would never, ever, ever make these days.
And I have to go back and rewatch Prisoner of Second Avenue.
Yeah.
Because Arthur Hiller directed that. And then, of course, he directs, and I'm trying to segue here into one of our topics, he directs my favorite late 20th century comedy, The In-Laws, Peter Falk.
The In-Laws, which I watched over this. You know, I made a whole list of everything. Every time I've watched a movie since March, I put it down on a list. So I don't mean to, you know, brag or one up you in anything, but you want to, can I run through quickly what I've watched?
Oh, absolutely. No, I want to know that.
Okay. First of all, I'm going to go in alphabetical order and I count the word all as being that. So all 4 of the Avengers movies, I finally tackled those. I did all 5 of the original Planet of the Apes movies. I finally got around to watching 10, which I'd never seen. I didn't like it. 1917, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, Aguirre, Wrath of God, which I loved, American Factory, documentary, Asphalt Jungle, Bad and the Beautiful, Bambi, because we had Disney Channel for about 2 months, because we wanted to watch Hamilton, The Battle of Algiers, terrific movie.
My God, that's fantastic.
Also known as Beauty and the Beast, 1946, Jean Cocteau, wonderful. Oh, my God, incredible. Best in Show, which I've seen a gazillion times, but I was in the mood. Billy Liar, 1963, which I didn't like so much. I wanted to. Birth of the Living Dead, documentary about Night of the Living Dead, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. Cat People, 1942, not the Nastassja Kinski, also great. Compliance was 2012. Have you ever heard of that one?
Compliance? I have, but I can't place it.
It's based on a real story. Sticks pretty close to the facts. It's about a fast food manager played by character actress named Anne Dowd, and she gets a phone call saying that from the police and saying that one of her employees has stolen from a customer, and they ask the manager to keep the employee in her office until the police can come. And then what happens is she keeps getting these phone calls like, well, we're on the way, we got stuck on something else, but in the meantime, can you strip search your employee? And it just becomes more and more humiliating. And what you find out midway through the movie, so it's not really a spoiler because they give it up not that long into it, is, of course, this is all one big prank by somebody. There is no police. And this person on the other line makes them, you know, just submits this poor young girl to all of this terrible, humiliating stuff because people are willing to go along with authority. That's the point. It's not like a snuff movie of, hey, let's watch a young girl be tortured for an hour.
It's kind of a take on the Stanford experiment.
It is. It's related to that. But this really did happen. I think not in Ohio, which the movies takes place, but I think like Kentucky or somewhere definitely Midwest or Southern Midwest. And it's a horrifying thing. And it's one of those ones where, you know, while you're watching, you're thinking, oh my God, I'd never do that if I were in that position. But on the other hand, it's like, you know what? You probably would. It'd be surprising how many people would just blindly follow, you know, an authoritative voice on the phone, you know, especially if it's a nice sounding voice and they're sprinkling in the compliments. You're doing a great job here, man. You could be a police officer yourself, etc. It's something else. Anyway, some more movies, Countess Dracula, which was a fantastic Hammer film that I saw in 1972. Drug War, which is a Enter the Dragon. I've never seen it. Bruce Lee, never saw it until this year. I liked it. It's good. You know, it's Bruce Lee. Florida Project, loved it. Galaxy Quest, I finally saw Galaxy Quest.
Because you had a question in here. Has Dan seen Galaxy Quest yet?
I like it a lot. I had not seen Galaxy Quest, and then, you know, I had no excuse not to because I had so much free time on my hands. You know, it was a lot of fun, and I'm not a Tim Allen guy at all, not just because of his politics, but just not a Tim Allen guy. But he was very good, and I love the alien, the actors playing the aliens. I thought they were the funniest part of the movie.
Oh, they were wonderful. Termites or something. Yeah. Did you watch the documentary?
No, I haven't seen that yet.
Because all the fun background of the making of that film makes the film itself even more engaging. Like the I know your son is using internet in the living room.
I think we slow down sometimes.
Yeah,
you know, certain times of the day.
If you're on Wi-Fi as opposed to a hard wire, you can drop out that way too. But you were talking about just not being a Tim Allen fan. I know exactly what you're talking about, I think, and I share that with you. But
yeah, I mean, even before he became, you know, a MAGA and all that stuff, just that, you know, ooh, and, you know, men do this and women do that. It's like, okay. Got any other jokes besides that one? You know, so that's me.
So,
I like them as Buzz Lightyear.
There's a passage in the documentary about Alan Rickman versus Tim Allen in terms of, you know, because there's that one scene where he's standing there with the makeup brush, you know, brushing his nose, and I had four curtain calls in Richard III. Yeah. And
right.
And that apparently there was a certain amount of reality to that.
Oh, dude.
Within the film.
I've spent most of my adult life around actors, you know, and, That's 100%. There's always that, you know, number four on the call sheet who's just waiting to play King Lear sort of thing, you know, or, you know, and he's now doing, you know, some shitty little thing. And he's like, you know, but once upon a time, I was the toast of the town sort of stuff. It's like, yeah. He's great. And he's Alan Rickman.
Right. Oh, by the way, Matt in San Francisco says the fast food worker movie. I stumbled upon that film and I concur. Very disturbing flick.
You see, that's the thing. What's his name? Matt?
Yeah, that's Matt in San Francisco.
Here's the thing, Matt. Maybe you're the same way. I am one of these people. Every once in a while, I want to be disturbed. You know, every once in a while, I don't want to go comfortable. I want to plumb the depths of my soul a little bit. You know, I want to come out of this wondering if humanity is all worth it. And that's one of those movies, but it's really well done. And I, you know, yeah, I'll chase it with, you know, something. I'll chase it with the in-laws the next day or something like that. But I just think you got to do that every once in a while. You got to take a good hard look at yourself and other people and just wonder, you know, how the hell can we be this way? You know? So good on you, Matt.
And I have a question. I have a question coming from Suman.
Yes, Suman.
Would you mind asking Dan what he thinks of the movie Tenet by Christopher Nolan, if you've seen it?
I didn't see it because I didn't go to a theater. I haven't been to a theater, I think, at all this calendar year. And maybe if I did, it would have been in January when the Oscar movies were still out. But, you know, I'm not going. I've, you know, I don't want to be a broken record about all this, but and maybe you don't know, I had a heart transplant two years and a month or so ago. I'm on immunosuppressants. There's no movie I'm going to go into a theater to see right now. It could be Wizard of Oz Part 2, starring the ghost of Judy Garland and directed by Steven Spielberg. I'm still not going to go into a movie theater. It's just the way it is.
Well, and Suman said, I thought it was the most innovative movie in the last couple of years. That this was the one risk that I took in the past 6 months. However, I went to the theater dressed up and masked up like I was going into Chernobyl, and I was only one of three people in the theater.
Well, that's good. I mean, you know, not good for the producers of Tenet, but good for you, you know. Listen, I'm not condemning it. I'm just telling you, you know, you make your choices, and I hope it's good choices for the best. But I personally, I like Nolan, you know, I'm not a Nolan fanboy. You know, I liked The Dark Knight a lot. You know, I liked a lot of his other stuff. But Dunkirk, I thought was okay. I didn't go all nutso over it the way a lot of people
did.
Yeah,
me neither.
You know, I appreciate what he does. I appreciate that he's trying to bring the spectacle, but yet also put some brains into the spectacle. You know, it's not just about punch, bam, boom. It's more than that, you know, the same way the Matrix movies are great that way, too. It's like, yeah, we're going to give you a lot of action and stuff, but we're going to also make you wonder, you know, is reality reality? Which is also, I guess, in a way, what's the movie that Nolan did with Leo? I'm just terrible with names these days.
Interstellar?
No, the other one. The Juno girl. God, I'm becoming my grandpa.
You're talking about The Revenant?
Yeah. No. Anyway, there's one where it's like, is reality reality? You know, and the spinning dreidel at the end of the movie and all that stuff. I like that one a lot, too. I haven't seen it.
Rosebud.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. So, anyway, you know, I'll see Tenet when it comes to streaming. And this might just be the way it is. Look, you know, maybe it's a good thing that you're seeing movies while you can, because I never thought I'd think this, but it's possible that we won't have movie theaters sometime in my lifetime. It'll go the way the 8-track tape. It's possible. You know, I know that AMC has you know, stated that if things don't pick up, AMC is going to go bankrupt before the end of the year. And they're one of the two, that and Regal are the two biggest chains for theaters in the country. So I don't know if movies are going to necessarily always be here, movie theaters. There'll always be movies, so we'll always have a need to be entertained. That leads me
back to a question I was going to ask you. That is, when I was asking about, you know, how long from post-production to premiere.
Yeah.
What kind of lag time are we looking at generally in the industry overall?
Well, you mean, movies, it's going to be big, long time lags. In New York City, we right now have 27 TV shows, streaming shows in production, with another 20 to 25 projected before March 2021. So we'll have, you know, anywhere from 25 to 40 something movies going at the same time. But we have exactly zero movies in production at the same time, and none in pre-production. There are movies being made. Philadelphia is an area where there is a movie being made right now. Stuff is going back up to Canada and to New Zealand. New Zealand's a big place.
Yeah, because they were smart enough to manage their damn virus.
Well, I'll tell you what's happening too is that New York City, you know, and we've done a very good job, you know, doing what we can with such a large, dense population. I think New York City has done a very good job in terms of controlling what we can control. I mean, I drive around the area and I see people walking down the street in masks everywhere in New York City, whereas in my suburb, I don't always see that. But the point I was going to make, too, is that filming in New York City right now is just nobody wants to do it, because it is a relatively small landmass with a large amount of people. And anybody that also wants to make a movie doesn't want to have in the background people wearing masks. So if you're going to film on the streets, you have to completely control the environment and bring in all of your own background. You can't catch anybody in the background just crossing the street, because they'll be wearing a mask and you're going to have to CGI that out at some point. And it's still very, it's hard. And I want to just get into, and I know I'm only at the G's right now, the movies that I've been, that I watched in the past.
And the thing is, you are engendering, you're engendering commentary from the community. People asking questions and just commenting along the way. For instance, Jude says, I'm enjoying the dialogue. It's like floating in this old rowboat, relaxing, and includes a picture of an old rowboat, and I can see the oar and the flotsam from the nearby ocean there in Washington State, and shells and driftwood and rounded stones. And so Jude's enjoying our conversation. Thank you, Jude. And Jack in Shreveport, question for Dan. Uh-huh. Question for Dan. Okay. I was wondering about something a few days ago, and today you have the guy that would know right on the show. I see credits on movies and TV, and I think that say CSA, which I guess is credentials for being somebody that is good at choosing actors for a part.
Casting Society of America.
Okay. Even if that isn't really correct, I was wondering how important it is to select the correct actor for a part, not counting physical characteristics, but just getting somebody that's the right fit. Or can actors pretty much do whatever's required, assuming they want the part? Maybe another way to put it is, how important is the selection of an actor or an ensemble of actors compared to the skill of the director? I hope that makes some kind of sense, Jack says.
Oh, it's 100% sense. And, you know, listen, Alfred Hitchcock, if you respect him as a filmmaker, I mean, he said that once he cast the movie and, you know, he had a good script, and once he cast the movie, if he did his job right, it wasn't directing at all for him. His directing was pretty much done, because he got the right people for the right part. And, you know, the history of film is just laden with stories of who could have been who in any given part, but instead, for whatever reason, you got this other person. You know, most famously, Ronald Reagan was considered to play the Humphrey Bogart part in Casablanca.
Dear God.
But he was, you know, he was a young up-and-comer at the time, and it could have happened.
And Buddy Ebsen had to bail out of Wizard of Oz because he was allergic to the makeup.
And listen, I mean, Buddy Ebsen is a fantastically talented, was a fantastically talented human being, and, you know,
hell of a
charming
offer.
And endearing. And, but, you know, to answer your question, who asked the question?
That was Jack.
Jack. To answer your question, it's just, you know, I was once an actor myself, and Bob knows this. I studied acting in college, and I used to think we were kind of told when we were all would-be actors that show business would be this form of meritocracy, that only the most talented would rise to the top and actually work consistently. And make no mistake, you have to be very talented in order to have a real career in film or television. But there's that certain X factor. There are actors that you just either like or don't like. And given a certain part, you know, could Tom Hanks play Hamlet? I don't know if he could, but I do know this, that when he plays, you know, all those other parts he's played in movies, doggone it, you just like him, you know, you like the guy. And you know, Jack Nicholson, you know, he's an incredible, a lot of people say, like, oh, he always plays himself, you know, he's always Jack Nicholson. But if you watch a lot of movies, you realize, no, there's a lot of variation to who Jack Nicholson really is. Yeah, he always has the goddamn voice and all that, and you always kind of know that it's Jack. But on the other hand, he brings to it a humanity and an unpredictability that's just exciting to watch. Now, there are some of my favorite actors. They are extremely versatile and they could play anything. Like, one of my favorites is Gene Hackman, because Hackman really could play just about anything. Or Robert Duvall could play a priest. He could play a gangster. He could play anything. And, you know, everybody says Meryl Streep is overrated. Not everybody. A lot of people say she's overrated. But the fact is, Meryl Streep can just really do friggin' anything. She could do comedy, she can cry, she can do the accents, she could play, she does everything. And very, very, very well, because she takes it seriously. So there's just something magical when you put the right person in the right part. And it's not that if you had put, you know, I'm trying to think of a good example. Well, if you had put Ronald Reagan in the part of Rick in Casablanca, he might have been a very, here's your word, Bob, adequate Rick. Nobody had big expectations of that movie anyway, Casablanca. Originally, it was called Everybody Goes to Rick.
Yeah, it was from a flop. It was from a Broadway flop.
Yeah, from a Broadway flop, and Bergman wasn't the first choice for Ilsa. I forget who it was. It was just sort of looked at as, well, it's just another, you know, potboiler here. It's just something. It's just going to be fluff and entertainment. And they were rewriting that movie every day. I mean, Jaws is another one. They literally rewrote Jaws every morning or every night. In the morning, they'd come in and they'd be handed these new pages. Now the scenes would be generally the same. Okay, on this scene, you're going to get in the boat. You're going to fire things at the shark. But, you know, things like we're going to need a bigger boat or the Indianapolis monologue, all of those things came about through either improv. You know, that was Roy Scheider's suggestion that we're going to need a bigger boat. And the Indianapolis monologue that Robert Shaw gives, I mean, I think that was written by like five different people, including Shaw. You know, Spielberg just sort of kept passing it around to his buddies. Like John Milius took a pass at it. So it took, you know, just for that, but it's one of the great scenes in all movies, the Indianapolis monologue. I don't know if there's a better monologue in film than that one. Do you? Maybe Peter Finch in Network, I'm mad as hell.
Yeah, I think the Indianapolis monologue just has such a magnificent slow burn to it.
And it just
because you've already invested a whole lot of time in the movie into really not liking Robert Shaw's character a whole bunch because he's mean and hateful and drunk and yeah.
But you know that's what movies do. Movies can make you love a mean, hateful drunk. Movies can make you take the side of a man who likes to dress up as his mother and stab women in the shower. You know, that's the magic of it. Citizen Kane, you know, is really Donald Trump, you know, in 1940 version, I should say. 41 is when Kane came out. Anyway, you know, the show that I love right now, Succession, fantastic show, but I shouldn't like it. There's no good reason I should like that show other than the fact it's perfectly written and acted and very well directed. But it's about rich white people doing rich white people things, you know, very greedy and self-centered and hateful people. But yet I don't hate them. That's magic. And a lot of that does come from casting, too. It's a face. It's a way people move. And it's a way somebody can tell a joke versus somebody who just can't for whatever reason.
And, you know, you mentioned Humphrey Bogart, Casablanca. He and Peter Falk are two classic cases of a physical deformity. Yeah, I don't know if we can still use that word. But a physical flaw almost creating a career. Early on, Peter Falk was told by one director, listen, I can hire an actor with two eyes for the same money I can pay for you. Because he lost an eye as a child. And that led to the way that he, you know, that he played so much of his work. And as a kid, Bogart, I think, was backhanded by his father, leading to a certain amount of paralysis in his upper lip.
Uh-huh.
And of course, that's how you wind up with
Strawberry.
Exactly, that classic Bogart sneer.
Yeah. Or fans of the Brady Bunch will know it as pork chops
and applesauce.
Sweetie.
Oh, my nose.
That's a whole other kitten caboodle there, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, I just remember. I remember our mutual and long-gone friend Mike Gillum doing that high as a kite all one night there in his apartment on Forest Avenue. Oh, my nose.
That's right. He did that. Yeah, folks, we're going to be telling some inside WVU from 30 years ago.
Yeah, we're down the rabbit hole at this point, but that's okay. Ron and Raleigh asked, have you watched The Boys?
I've not seen it yet. It looks something else.
I've thought about it, but I haven't clicked on it yet. But Ron asks, is it really difficult for American actors to get work? It seems virtually every movie and TV show now stars British or Australian actors.
I don't know what to tell you. I mean, look, there's always scenes. There's so many things on now. I'm sure that if you broke it down statistically, you'd find that things are pretty much about in many ways the same. Look, a lot of ways it's very different in that we have a lot more actors of color now. We have fewer and fewer necessarily white male protagonists, and the protagonists can be different color or different sex or this or that. That it's not necessarily the default. That it's going to be somebody that looks like Jack Lord. It could be somebody that looks like Viola Davis. And that's great. But as far as American and not American, you know, it's true. I've worked with a lot of, you know, I did The Americans. I was a prop master on that show for the final two seasons. And our lead actor was Welsh, Matthew Rhys.
Right.
And he was flawless. You know, you wouldn't know on the show. If you watch the show, you wouldn't. I don't think you could tell that he had an affected accent.
No. His American accent is as American as you would expect the Soviets to teach a Soviet spy to be.
Yeah, I'm just full of blanks tonight. But I did work once with a British actor that, in between takes, I asked him, like, how is it that you guys can do American accents so well? I mean, you know, Americans still, we all sound like Dick Van Dyke and Mary Poppins, you know, hello, Governor! You
know. How are you now?
Hey, what's that?
They taught me to walk and talk and act just like a blooming lady.
Oh, yeah. But he told me that, you know, as a kid, you know, every kid in the UK grew up watching American television, cowboy shows, police shows. So they all just like mimicked the especially kids who wanted to be actors, just mimicked the people they saw on TV. And that's how you get an American accent. I mean, you listen to Paul McCartney, he still has Liverpool and he's in his voice. And he's been, you know, an international citizen for six decades now. So, it's a choice, I suppose. And people like, you know, people like Matthew Rhys or Meryl Streep or whatever. Some people just have a facility for it. I never did. I mean, it's as an actor, it was something that took a lot of work for me. I did one role once. I don't know if you saw it when I was in a Harold Pinter play called The Homecoming.
Yes.
And I had to do an accent. And that was fun, but it's something that's like you have to get all the other stuff down first, and then you kind of layer the accent on top of it. And you have to keep doing the accent like all through your day so that it just becomes, you don't even think about it, you know? So I'd be like in my, you know, cooking dinner or something in my apartment at the time. And I'd be like, you know, hey, you know, I can't even do it now. I'd be like, pass the salt, mate, you know, sort of thing. And you do have to be sort of method about it just so you don't, you know, think about it on the stage or beside it. But yeah, I don't know. I guess also British actors, they're very well trained. They really are.
They are taught differently.
They're taught differently. There's just a grace. Like, there's a physical grace to a lot of British actors I have found just watching, at least the ones I have. You know, you watch how Olivier moves. He moves beautifully. Just, he could walk across the room, and it's just enchanting.
Well, and that loops us back to the Tim Allen, Alan Rickman thing, because, you know, the classic story, and maybe it's apocryphal, is the exchange between Olivier and Dustin Hoffman in Marathon Man. You know that old story, right?
I do. I've actually read things since that Olivier himself refuted that story. That Olivier supposedly said that wasn't true. But maybe it was Dustin Hoffman who said that Olivier said that it wasn't true. I don't know. But
But the thing is,
when the legend becomes more interesting than the fact, print the legend.
Right, exactly. And it goes to that. And I think it has to do something with our overall, you know, on the one hand, we're Merck, goddammit. Yeah, we're the greatest in the country, in the world, universe, forever under God, amen. And on the other hand, we've got this giant inferiority complex, especially where the arts, acting, and so forth are concerned. I mean, what you said about the British actor saying, you know, we grow up watching American television is very much true, because if you consider, you know, you mentioned Paul McCartney, but, you know, the Stones, and they're all listening to American rock and roll and right. trying to sound American and black.
That's right.
And that's so right. that's, you know, that's how Mick Jagger becomes Mick Jagger.
Do you know, supposedly Mick Jagger, when he first came to the U.S., to New York City, he would go to I think James Brown had like a 2-week stand at the Apollo. And supposedly Mick Jagger went every single night and just stood backstage and watched James move and sing. Did you know that?
I'd never heard that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm rereading a favorite book of mine called Nowhere to Run by Jerry Hershey, which is a story of American soul music. And, you know, it's not Crime and Punishment, but it's a terrific book and a lot of fun to read. But you know, but it is true that there's something about the accents that just it makes when I'm in the presence of a Brit, I just automatically feel my IQ drop. You know, I just feel like such an idiot, you know, because everything they say is just sounds so brilliant.
I'm so goddamned intelligent, even if they're talking about their toe hair.
Yeah, you know. Say what you will about the teeth or the food, but you just think they're smart automatically with that. And I imagine you could get whatever you wanted if you really wanted to exploit that in terms of money or sex or power. Just use that, use it, and you can get things. But I think also it is true that we do have an inferiority complex. Like, I was never the hugest fans of like the Merchant Ivory movies, and Downton Abbey, like the first season, I liked.
I've never seen a single frame of it.
It's okay if you like, you know, British accents and fine clothing and pretty furniture and nice soap opera conundrums. It's a good show. And, you know, I watched The Crown. I've watched all 3 seasons of that. And I like the first 2. Okay, pretty good. And the 3rd one I didn't really like all that much. But it's like, oh, it's so great. It's so great. Well, yeah, it's good. But it's no greater to me than Watchmen. It's no greater to me than RoboCop. You know, anything that's like well made. I don't care if it's about a robot cop or a fraternity house, you know, of misfits. If it's well made, it's well made. And just because it has British accents and pretty furniture doesn't necessarily mean it's a masterpiece, you know. I mean, it can be boring as hell, you know, even if pretty people are you know, trying to get Mr. Darcy to fall in love with them or whatever.
I made it through, I think Agnes and I made it through 3 seasons of Outlander. And then we quit watching primarily. And it wasn't me, because it was Agnes who said, you know, I can't stand Claire anymore. She's a perpetual fuck up. Enough of this. She's going to get that poor cute Scotsman killed again. So it wore thin after a while.
Well, sometime or other, I don't know when it will ever be. I'd love to sit on a couch and watch something with Agnes. I bet she'd be.
Oh, she was so mad. She got so mad during My Octopus Teacher. I guess I'll just let slide a little spoiler. There's a point at which a pajama shark, I didn't know there were such things, but they've got stripes on them like they're wearing striped pajamas.
This just sounds more and more like Pixar. You know, I can hear Baby Shark playing over.
Yeah, I know, but it's not. A pajama shark, which is the natural predator of an octopus, and you've fallen in love with the octopus by now because she's just so wonderful. I mean, she has a real stage presence there under the water, Dan. But a pajama shark attacks her, and Agnes is looking at the protagonist, the diver, the documentarian, going, help her, you fuck, you know, because Agnes will drop the occasional F-bomb too. You miserable, because I think that's exactly what everybody watching the film is thinking.
Yeah.
Jesus, you care about this octopus, and it's not a big shark. I mean, it's not a Jaws shark. It's just this little pissant shark, and you can slap it and No, it does. Because all of a sudden he gets all Star Trek Prime Directive and says, I can't interfere with the workings of nature. I'm like, dude, what planet do you think you're living on? That's all we do as humans. Make it be for good for once.
Yeah, it's the thing about, you know, it's one of the differences between a good movie and a bad movie. Is that thing, it can be a horror movie, it can be a romantic movie, where there's like the stupid obstacle. You know, every plot has to have an obstacle, right? Because we all know it's very basic drama 101. Every story is about a protagonist wanting something and the struggle to achieve that thing. And at some point you think all is lost. And by the end, the protagonist has either achieved the goal, which is how most movies end in these days, or has failed in the goal, which was more of like a Greek tragedy kind of thing.
And, exactly. You
know, downer 1970s cinema. So where was I going with this? Oh, God. The stupid obstacle, yeah. Right? You're watching a horror movie, and all they have to do is leave the house, like the Haunted House movie, Amityville Horror, or Burnt Offerings, or something like that. All they have to do is just say, you know,
it ain't worth it.
Let's just go to a hotel.
Right.
You know, this is creeping me out and I don't like it. And yeah, we're down for this mortgage. But let's just, you know, we just had our maid just was decapitated and the dog is just caught on fire. So maybe let's just leave this place, get a hotel room and try to figure out how we can get out of this mortgage because this isn't working out. They don't do that, you know. And even in like non-horror movies, superhero movies like Batman, the Batman with Michael Keaton and Jack Nicholson of 90, maybe was that 1990 or so?
Yeah, 1990.
You know which one I'm talking about. The first Tim Burton Batman.
I'm Batman.
Movie and everything, right? But at the very end, they have to do that thing where, you know, Kim Basinger, you know, is kidnapped by the Joker. And what does he do? He climbs up a tower with her. It's always the tower. Every you know what, it started with King Kong.
King Kong, exactly. Yep.
All the bad guys ever since, it's like, oh, Batman's chasing after me. I could jump into this plane and get out of here. But I think instead I'll go into this abandoned factory that makes sparks and I'll climb up this large tower.
Abandoned spark factory. Wait a minute. There. All better now.
I stole that line, though, from Patton Oswalt, so you could give that to Patton, too, the factory that makes
sense. Yeah, but it was in the moment.
But I remember
it. Like the Jeffrey Toobin story last night, but...
yeah. So, and like romantic movies, too. There's, you know, these romances, it's always like, oh, but I just can't fall in love with you because, you know, I'm engaged to this obvious drip that everybody's telling me I should break. You know, it's like, just get you know, the obvious thing would be in the first 10 minutes, they get together because they're meant to beat it, but you have to create these obstacles that you have an hour and a half to 2 hours of content. And the good ones can do it. You know, I mean, say what you will about Spielberg, but like when he does it well, he'll do these things like Indiana Jones is in an impossible situation and he sometimes gets out of it. You know, somehow he does it. Whereas like the bad movies just sort of like, oh, you know, here happens to be a trap door that nobody ever talked about before. You know, let's go through that. Oh, now we're out of it. It's like, no, it can't be that easy. It's got to be hard, and it can't be luck. It has to be something.
Yeah, it's the difference between not seeing the crane of the Deus Ex Machina and seeing the crane.
That's right. You know, all I really want, I want to be surprised. You know, I want somebody to think of something I have never thought of before. That's why.
No, that's like my approach to watching. My approach to watching magicians, and I've got a very dear friend who is a professional magician. He's a professional magician, and he started it when we were in high school together. And I always enjoyed watching him and other magicians. And the one thing I don't do is sit there and think, how'd he do that? I know intellectually that there's no magic, but I want to enjoy the illusion for the sake of the illusion and not sit there and engage in a bunch of intellectualism trying to sort it. Why? I mean, if that's all you're going to do is wonder how they did it, why bother watching? Because you know that it's legerdemain.
Well, I'm going to take the counterpoint to this one. You can call me. You want to call me Shauna, the ignorant slut? You want to do that? Because I'm going to counterpoint on you here.
Jane, you ignorant slut.
Right. I do. In fact, I when I watch a movie, pre-CGI movies, I love watching stuff with effects from the old school, where I'm the whole time I'm not only blown away by something, but I do wonder, like, how did they do that? Before all you had to do was do a few clicks with your mouse, how did they do that? You know, the movie The Right Stuff, you know, they did all these flight scenes. A lot of it was just them literally making a model airplane, like a 4-foot model Glamorous Glynis, and tossing it out a window and filming it as it flew through the air until the crash. That's how they did that stuff. But the way they did it, and that it is like magic. Filmmaking, so much of filmmaking really is like what a magician does. It's misdirection. While I'm getting the thing in my right hand, you just can't help but look at my left hand, because I'm making the left hand so interesting that you're just not noticing how obvious it is that I'm palming the card with my right. That's what a good magician does and what a good filmmaker does. And yes, a good prop person, too. So much of what I've done in my life has been like, I've been told, like, okay, we want to have a washing machine, but the washing machine has to spit out the clothing after the actor says the word, you know, bless you. And so, you know, you have to figure that out, because washing machines aren't meant to do that, right? It can be much simpler stuff where it's like it can be a thing like, well, I want the actress to be writing with a pen, and I want the ink to suddenly dry out, and I don't want to cut away. I want it to all be in the same shot. Well, 1 minute she's writing, and then the pen ink dries up. Can you do that? And so things like that. That's how we used to have to do it when I first got into the business. We had to figure out, oh, you know, I have to figure out what switch can the actress touch on the pen that can make the ink flow stop, or, you know, a retractable knife when somebody gets stabbed, how can I make that knife not look like a phony retractable knife you get at the Halloween store? How can I make this look real? You know, we have syringes too, the whole thing. You know, the needle actually goes into the syringe body, into the whatever that. So, but nowadays we don't have to worry about any of that. On gun scenes now, we don't have to use blanks anymore, because we can just have an actor hold a gun and do just sort of that jerky motion with his or her hand, and then they're just going to put in a flash and some smoke and the noise, all of that in post-production, you know, or the knife. I've had scenes where actors have been stabbed, you know, or characters have been stabbed, and all I hand them over now is a knife handle and no nothing pointy at all, so that the actor can just plunge the knife handle right at the chest. Nobody gets hurt. It doesn't even sting. It's slightly annoying, if anything. And then everything else is put in through the magic of CGI. And I just think that's less fun. As a movie viewer, I know how the trick is done. I know over and over and over how CGI more or less works. I like not knowing how it works. And I do like being the, by golly, I wonder how they do it. You know, one of those types that you claim you will never be. I am that guy, and I don't mind it. And I'm Dan Fisher, and I endorse this announcement.
Well, and I think it's perfectly normal and acceptable for somebody in your position to do that. That's you wondering how some, you know, other magicians look at my buddy Steve and they say, I bet I know, or I wonder how, because you're part of the confraternity.
Right. But also, like, long before I worked in film, I mean, I just was that kid. Like, you know, the first time I saw Planet of the Apes, I saw it back in 1971 or two. I think they had a reissue where they re-released it in theaters with the sequel, with one of the sequels. And I saw the original for the first time in a theater. And I really came out of it just saying, like, how did they do that? I want to do it, too. I want to do that. And I was 7 or 8 years old, and already I knew how did they do that? I really wondered and started reading about that how do they do these things? I was one of those kids. No, not everybody is, you know, and God bless them. We can't have all, you know, we need an audience. We need people to you know, have no interest in making it, but want to consume it as much as they can. And that's
you talked about the possible demise of movie theaters. How much does the, and this may sound like a silly question, I don't intend it as such, How much does the film industry rely on revenues from movie theaters?
Well, it still relies tremendously. Certainly the theatrical feature market does. The movie theaters, though, have been, you know, the American portion of that has just grown less and less important through the years and the decades, where it's been about the international market. It's been making movies with as little dialogue as possible, with as much action as possible, so that you could rule the box office in China or in Australia, and all of those so-called supplemental markets. There have been movies that have not done particularly well here that for whatever reason caught on hugely in other countries and certainly made the profit. But now I don't know how, you know, I'm not a producer and I learn about the economics of the film business the way any of your listeners do. For the most part, I read about them online or anywhere else. So what I do feel is that how all of this stuff is being made and distributed, it's all changing. And we're in a process right now of enormous transition because of this disease. And it's not just theaters. You know, I mentioned earlier that there's a lot of TV shows coming to New York City to film, which is good. But a lot of those now, we're trending towards shorter and shorter shows, half-hour shows, as opposed to the hour-long serialized thing. There seems to be a lot of stuff in production now that's half-hour. It could be serialized, but a lot more sort of like sketch comedy type stuff. Like, what was that show with the two, Broad City, stuff like that, where it's each episode can sort of be independent from one another. And it's easier to make. And two character, three character, less stuff like the thing I'm doing now. This show that I've been doing for Apple, the day before we shut down, we had a scene with 300 background extras. It was probably actually a little ill-advised because we knew that the coronavirus thing was starting to happen. But we had a scene with 300 extras. And then the next day we were told to pack up our stuff. We're going to shut down for, at the time we were told 2 weeks, and it wound up being from March to the end of August, however many months that is. I did want to talk.
Let me get a couple of other, we got a comment from our buddy Ron in the far, not quite frozen north yet. In other words, far Canoodlia, going back to our discussion of British versus American actors and who gets hired. Ron says, it's fine to criticize the Brits and Australians taking real American acting jobs, but please don't start on the impressive number of Canadian comedians who do well in the U.S. Trump will try to find some way to slap a tariff on it or restrict their work permits. Mm. So point well taken. And
well taken. I mean, you know, how many of the original Saturday Night Livers came from Canada? It was Danny Aykroyd, Gilda Radner, Belushi was Chicago, but and then SCTV, of course, was
y'all.
And then you moved
to Kids in the Hall.
I don't know if any of your listeners will know. You can find them on
YouTube.
Michael
J. Fox.
There was a comedy troupe that never quite made it that I'm actually a big fan of. I'd like to plug called Picnic Face. And just check them out sometime if you like that sort of Kids in the Hall stuff. If you put Picnic Face in YouTube, you'll get like a whole channel of stuff. I think they had a Comedy Central series for one season, and it just didn't take off. But that group is just so funny and so talented. I mean, the videos are now probably like 20 years old.
And plus the Canoodlians have educated your children.
They have indeed. My daughter is in Montreal right now. McGill University, which is where my son graduated, and my daughter's in her final year. They're not having in-person classes. It's all online. But she's up there just because she had spent from March to August living back here with mom and dad, and she just needed to get back to living an independent life, which I don't blame her at all. And so she's back up in her apartment in Montreal. And it's much safer there, too, you know, obviously, than it is here.
Yes, because for some reason or another, they seem to be vastly more intelligent than we are. The Canadians. Yeah. Go figure. Yeah. Go figure. But
Brits, and we've talked about the Brits being supposedly intelligent. I mean, they've had a terrible response to it, almost as bad as ours.
And because they are experiencing starting with. You know, I was pondering just yesterday the degree to which Brexit mirrors the secession fervor in the United States in the 1850s and up to 1860. You know. Well, if that Lincoln gets elected, we just going to secede here in South Carolina. Whoa. And that's basically what Brexit is. Brexit is secession from the European Union. And at least we've gotten far enough down the road now that all the parties recognize that it's really not worth having another massive continent-wide European war over.
Well, and wasn't there a lot of sort of buyer's remorse to Brexit? It was sort of like one of these things that was a momentary, like, fuck yeah. And then as soon as it got initiated, it was sort of like, do we really want to do this? Am I wrong in that?
No,
impression?
I mean, around half the country is still divided in large part over whether it was the right idea in the first place. And of course, they got messed with by the Russians, too, just like we did. But, you know, just as we still have Trump, they still have Boris. And so they, you know, they've got their own mask hole COVIDiots. Whereas it seems like Canada just simply understands how bad this is. And they really don't want to be us.
Yeah. My impression of Canadians is they really do. Look at us. They pay attention to what we're doing, and a lot of times we're like the unruly, sloppy brother, you know, or the embarrassing cousin or something. I mean, on the other hand, we're like the embarrassing, sloppy brother cousin who's got a lot of money. Like, we still kind of made out, you know, we made out well, and there's a reason that a lot of Canadian comedians and actors and all kinds of types have come to America to make their fortune, as they say in Godfather. You know, we're still America, and it's still an impressive as hell place for as fucked up as it is. There's so much wealth, there's so much land, occupied land, you know, and warm. We're much warmer than a great amount of the Canadian landscape.
Yeah.
So
that's why I've always been in favor of Canada annexing the Turks and Caicos Islands so that I could immigrate to the Turks and Caicos and be a Canadian.
You know, I got to just say, I'm going about as far as I can in terms of opining about Canada and international relations. I feel like I've got to swim out back and hold on to the life preserver of Josie and the Pussycats
I understand. And we only got to G, right?
Rockville High School. Yeah. Well, I don't want to, you know, we've got 45 minutes now. I mean, some of the other great ones, you know what I saw? I just knocked me out. It was The Harder They Come, Jimmy Cliff movie.
Oh,
ever
wow.
Seen that one?
Yep.
Probably had the soundtrack, because everybody has the soundtrack. And it's not that it's a great movie. In a lot of ways, it's a cheesy movie. But what's great about it is that they made this movie in Kingston, Jamaica, in the late 60s, early 70s. And it stars Jimmy Cliff, a reggae singer who had never acted before. And he's not a great actor. I mean, it's sort of like your Jack, was it, that asked the question about casting. Like, you could put a much, much better actor in that part in The Harder They Come than Jimmy Cliff. But on the other hand, he's just so friggin' charismatic and just natural. You know, there's no acting at all. He's just sort of given a character he can play. Sort of like I liked Eminem in 8 Mile because he was just sort of just reacting to stuff more or less honestly, you know, without a whole lot of flourish to it. But The Harder They Come, the best thing about that movie is just you're seeing like 1970 streets of Kingston and also like going into like these weird sort of hardcore black evangelical churches and seeing these ceremonies where people are like flipping onto the floor and going into these spasm attacks and things like that. And you're just seeing this and hearing this great music. And then there's this whole plot where he becomes this gangster outlaw, like a Bonnie and Clyde thing. And it, in a lot of ways, the plot is all over the place. The plot doesn't matter. It's all about atmosphere, and it's all about the people in the camera. Most of the cast, they're not professionals at all. They're like friends of Jimmy Cliff or people that he found. And that one just knocked me out. And then other movies I saw that I got into this thing of watching silent movies because I watched this show called Berlin Babylon, which takes place in
Germany. God, I love that.
Isn't that a great show? And then, yeah, for the uninitiated, it's on Netflix. You can watch it either with subtitles or dubs. I didn't mind the dubs. I kind of liked the dubs for some reason. I usually hate dubs. I didn't mind it. But either way, it's fantastic storytelling and just incredible. It's like Germany, like 5 years before Hitler would come into power, and Berlin, and just the decadence of it. It's like cabaret, but without music. Well, there are great musical numbers in it, but also just like drug use and crime and murder and sexual perversity. It's great. But, you know, the last season of that show that I saw, it was all about the German silent expressionist film era, and they were making a movie in the yes. show. So it got me into watching stuff like Metropolis and The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and all that. And I saw, was it A Flight to the Moon?
Yes, I was about to mention that, the mother of science fiction.
It's not German, but still, yeah. And there's another example. It's like, you know, in a lot of ways, you know what the effects are. But still, the fact that they made it in 1917, it's amazing that they just said, let's make this thing and let's have space aliens dancing around and suddenly disappearing because somebody thought, what if I stopped the camera and the actor jumped out of the shot and started the camera again? What would happen? And that's how they discovered the effect that was used all the way through the Bewitched series. So I've kind of gotten into that black and white, silent, expressionist cinema for some reason.
Now, does the lovely Helene participate in these viewings, or does she find that just a little too esoteric?
The lovely Helene, who is nobody's fool when it comes to intellectualism,
right,
or things like that. When she settles down, when the work is done for her, she wants, and she'll say it, she wants stupid TV. She calls it stupid TV. Like she'll watch Black Mirror, Black Arrow, Black something, Black Lightning. I don't know. There's some like superhero show now that she's watched a bunch of. And she watched all of Outlander, and she knew it was trash. But she's like, this is fun, pretty trash that I don't have to think about. Me, on the other hand, like I watched the other night Titicut Follies. Do you know about that one?
No.
It was a documentary. It was a documentary filmmaker named Frederick Wiseman. And his story was he graduated from Yale Law School. And he was a law professor, I think at BU. And then he had heard about the horrific conditions in the Massachusetts Prison for the Criminally Insane, as it was called at the time. And so he decided he wanted to make a documentary. He wanted to film the conditions within this insane asylum. And he somehow got his way in there. And he took a camera, and it's all black and white. And the movie, it was groundbreaking for a documentary because up until then, documentaries were pretty much like you had a narrator and a very straight through line of a story. You know, this is how steel is made in this plant. You know, here are the rubber tires coming down the assembly line. That sort of thing. But what Wiseman did is he just filmed, and he cut it together in a way that it doesn't feel like you're watching a story. It doesn't feel like there's structure until the end of the movie, and you realize that you've gone through a journey that you have, and it's a horrific journey. But there's no narration. It's just crazy people doing crazy people things. But more importantly, it's a system which has utterly failed them. It's horrific. They have I'm going to call them the inmates because they aren't really the patients because they weren't being tended to like hospital patients. They're treated like inmates, but these are mentally dangerous people. You know, it's criminally insane for a reason, but these were men, human beings that would have them just take, they would just have them be naked, like just because it was too much bother to wash and tend to their clothes. So there'd be men just walking around all day long, nude, like animal, just literally treated like animals and put into rooms without a speck of furniture and just locked in there all day. So you're naked and you're alone in a room. And because you you had the bad break of being born with problems that make you criminally insane, and taunting from the guards and horrific conditions. And what happened is after the movie premiered at one of the film festivals and got all this acclaim and all this attention, suddenly the state of Massachusetts brought a court injunction against it. Because it did not make the state of Massachusetts look good at all.
Another case of banned in Boston?
It was banned from 1967 to 1991 on the grounds that it violated the privacy of the individuals depicted. And I have to admit, like when I'm watching this movie and I'm seeing these men who are, again, like a lot of them are naked, you're seeing everything, not in a tantalizing way, just in a very matter-of-fact way, all this, and you're seeing these men who are very, just babbling on and on, psychotic, schizophrenic. It's very disturbing to watch. But and I'm watching, I'm thinking, do these men, I'm sure they had to sign something, some form of consent, or a guardian had to, but did they really know what they would be getting themselves into? And is it really fair? But on the other hand, what it did is expose these terrible conditions. And then, yeah, Massachusetts shut it down and saying that it invaded all these people's privacy. So finally, in 1991, Wiseman was able to prove that every person depicted in the film was dead. So there was no more privacy to invade. So they finally reintroduced it. And it's amazing. And Wiseman went on to make a whole bunch of films and is still making films. I think he's 87 years old now. And it's still the same thing. He just films. He just observes. He cuts it together. So somehow or other, there is a structure, but it's not the traditional thing that you think of documentaries. There's never narration. He's done it about high schools, oftentimes systems and how systems go wrong. High schools, criminal courts, police stations and police organizations, political campaigns, just how things go wrong from an individual, systemic and individual standpoint. Fascinating stuff. I recommend that. I watch that on Canopy, which I'm always plugging when I come on your show. I love Canopy. That's a free streaming service you can get through your library.
Public library, sorry, right. Yeah.
Public libraries. Not every library, unfortunately. Your library has to participate, but if you're so lucky, I hardly recommend it. You get 10 free movies a month with a lot of strong emphasis on classics, foreign films, documentaries, avant-garde, indie cinema, and a lot of retrospectives of stuff that I like How Night of the Living Dead was made, or Johnny Carson, the Tonight Show documentary about that, Tower Records. So it's something for everybody, but especially a serious movie watcher like myself. So that kind of answers your question too. I like delving into that, and I just get impatient with stupid. I like entertaining, but it has to be well done. It can't be stupid.
You like a little bit of a challenge.
I do, I mean, I did. Again, I liked Avengers. By the fourth Avengers movie, I was sort of done with them, but I stuck them out. But I don't like things where it's just like Independence Day. That movie, what was it, 1997 or so? Didn't like it because it was just so stupid. I couldn't surrender to the stupid on that one. Not even with Will Smith, who was really charming and everything. But the whole movie was just idiocy from beginning to end.
I know I talk a lot about it. You mentioned Will Smith. For me, the first Men in Black movie just gets better and better and better and better.
I worked on
You worked on that?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I've got a Men in Black poster in my house to memorialize that. Yeah. I wasn't the prop master. I mean, I was one of a team of about eight or nine prop people. But yeah. I was there. There's a scene in Men in Black, just a little shot where there's a baseball game happening at Shea Stadium. The Mets are playing somebody, and
the center fielder the center fielder takes a baseball in the head because he's looking at the spaceship.
That baseball, that's me.
You threw the baseball?
Yeah. What it was we had this unit that went out. It was a small unit. And I went out to Shea Stadium, and for 3 hours or so, I was paid to sit and watch a ball game while the camera crew just got footage of the game. And, obviously the players on the field didn't need props. But then when the game was over and the stadium cleared out, we had the player, I forget his name. He wasn't a big time player. We had some player and he stayed afterwards and he was in his uniform and we went out to right field and I got on a ladder and I had like a rubber ball with the stitching and stuff to make it look like a real baseball. And yeah, for about, I got paid then at like 3 o'clock in the morning, I was paid to just repeatedly throw a rubber ball and hit that guy in the head for about 15 or 16 takes until they decided it was good. I love my job sometimes. You know?
Okay, you know, that's one of those films that will get people commenting. And Jeremy in Vermont just wrote in and said, when Will Smith is filling out the test form and the pencil breaks, classic. Do you have anything to do with the pencil?
No, because a lot of that was also, basically, if it was filmed inside, this is the big set, that was L.A. We did all the New York stuff because it takes place in New York. So they did all this stuff in the studio in L.A. For anything that was pretty much interior. Then all the New York stuff, like the street stuff. We also filmed in the Whitney Museum, which was a real tough get for our people. You know, money does a lot of good stuff. We filmed in the Whitney for that. What else? But my big job on that was actually, too, the Men in Black Mobile.
The Ford? The Ford POS?
Yeah, that was a thing where it was like, okay, whenever we see the car, it has to be spotless. Like the camera cannot pick up so much as a thumbprint. So after every take, I was, you know, my job was to go in with a chamois and just, you know, get out every little smudge, you know, however minute, because it had to be perfect in every shot. So that was part of the thing I did. Oh, another thing I did, there is a shot where the bug, Edgar, the bug monster, played by Vincent D'Onofrio, is driving the bug van into the city. And he's sort of going up this large incline highway, and you see the city in the background. This, and I'm actually driving that van. Vincent D'Onofrio didn't do it. I did.
Oh, how cool! Yeah, because that role was he played that just magnificently. And
it's great.
You know, it's become, you know, movie lines inveigle their way into your lives. And there's a million. So when I can't find my shoes, and Agnes will be in some other part of the house, a Vincent D'Onofrio Men in Black line will emerge from my mouth because it's just so perfect to the moment. Oh, where is it? And then she knows immediately, and she's magic that way. And all she has to do is walk into the room, and whatever I'm looking for will magically appear right in front of my eyes.
Huh.
But, you know, that's just.
That was it.
And by the way, Darlene in Connecticut just wrote in a little bit ago and said, oh, my God, did Dan just invoke Josie and the Pussycats? That's hilarious. How did he come up with that out of the blue? When I was a little girl, that was my favorite show, and I wanted to have Josie's hairstyle so badly that I'd stand in front of the mirror for hours trying to use bobby pins and barrettes to get my hair to look like hers. To no avail, of course. So where did the Josie and the Pussycats reference come from?
It's always there, Bob. It's the same way that I'll always know the lyrics. Josie and the Pussycats, long tails and ears for hats, guitars and sharps and flats, each week a groovy song, everybody come along. I'm always going to know that, you know? I might be some senile old coot someday.
It'll be the last thing that leaves.
It'll be my rosebud, and, you know, I'll be lying in a bed, not able to recognize my own wife and children, but I'll be like, Josie and the Pussycats. That's the curse and blessing of my life. It just is. You know, it's.
Well, among the other lists that you have is a list of great 70s or at least 70s Saturday morning viewing.
Yeah. Let me pull that up. Because we did a little prep for this, folks, just a little bit.
We just jaw. That's all we do. We just jaw.
Yeah. Okay, where do I got it here? These are mine. Now, this is the thing, too. You know, I'm 56, going to be 57 in March. And I know Bob is perpetually 39, but I will tell you that he went to college in the same years I went to college. So, you know, we're 1970s guys. We grew up principally kind of in the 1970s. Now, I'm not saying that these cartoons are better than the ones you might have grown up with if you're a little younger than us. That if you're in your 40s, you might think that, you know, He-Man, Master of the Universe is the text.
Thundercats.
I'm not going to tell you you're wrong or that Powderpuff Girls, if you were a 90s kid.
I'm a big Powerpuff Girls and Johnny Bravo fan.
Yeah. Yeah. And plus, P.S., my sister, Kath, who's also a West Virginia native, has done some voiceover work for the Steven Universe cartoon.
No kidding.
She does voiceover and stuff. And we'll actually, maybe before this hour is over, I'll talk a little bit about her and some other stuff. But my preamble was all just about that I'm not one of those people that says, oh, everything from my generation was the best and everything that came after that sucks. I don't believe in that. If it means something to you, it means something to you. I'm not even going to tell you that, you know, I hate the movie Grease, but I know that a lot of people love the movie Grease. I could argue with you. It's fun to argue with you if you're in the mood for that. But on the other hand, I'm going to respect the fact that it just means something to you. Yeah. Same way Planet of the Apes, Night of the Living Dead. Those movies mean something to me.
I went to the movie 3 times when Xanadu was in the theaters. And then I watched it as a full grown adult. And wow. Just.
Yeah. I did mention earlier, I saw all the 5 Planet of the Apes movies over the break. And they just get progressively cheaper and more horrible as they go along. And I remembered as a kid thinking this is Ben-Hur, Citizen Kane, all wrapped up into one. I was wrong, you know. Xanadu.
But it was what you needed at the time. And Xanadu spoke to my little pubescent romantic soul, and I knew I was never going to be a roller skater because I fell down a lot. But damn, Olivia Newton-John was beautiful.
She was a vision in that white dress. And the hair, and the feathered hair, and everything like that.
Yeah. Oh.
That's another.
And the costumes. I mean, the other costumes from the different eras. You know, with the Andrews sisters look and all of that, and yeah.
Yeah, the listener who was lamenting about her inability to resemble Josie. Who is that? What's her name?
That was Darlene in Connecticut.
Darlene, let me just tell you this: the 1970s for me, it was a rough era for hair. Because it was the era, if you had that feathered hair, you know, that sort of like Sean Cassidy thing, which later sort of became the John Travolta thing, you were the king of your junior high school. My hair would never and will never feather. My hair does what it wants to do. It's just this cactus thing. It just and it's not even thick. It's thin, fine hair. I'm grateful I have hair. I still have it. But just, you know, we all went through some pretty awkward 1970s stuff, and I'm sure that you're.
You remember 1983, the year we met. You know, I had Peter Frampton hair when Peter Frampton was seriously out of fashion. You know, because it just hung in strawberry blonde ringlets, and I looked like a cross between Larry Fine and Peter Frampton.
And I had a mullet at the time because I was in. Emulating Bono, I thought if I had a mullet, I could pull it off like Bono or Simon Le Bon. And I, looking back, I didn't. I mean,
but it's not just, nobody did.
Nobody did.
There was a lot of work that went into those perfect mullets, and the work went into making them look effortless.
Okay, but I did come up with a list of my 10 favorite Saturday morning shows. Now I don't even say cartoons because it's not necessarily all animated.
Right.
Cartoons. And one is actually not from the 1970s. Okay, my number one of all time, and it's going to be no shock to anybody because it's a lot of people's, is Bugs Bunny.
Absolutely.
It's just best. And the thing is that's great about Bugs Bunny is these things were made in the 1940s, you know, and 50s. And yet, you know, we were watching this stuff in the 70s and throughout, as far as I know, they're watching it now somewhere. And yet, you know, it didn't matter that you didn't get the references to Edward G. Robinson or George Jessel.
But it opened the door to learning about those things.
Even if you didn't want to learn about them, you could still go around in your backyard going like, listen, you're dirty rat. You know, you could do that because it was funny.
It's curtains for you. Oh, they're adorable.
And, yeah. You know, Bugs, it's just the level of filmmaking on a lot of those ones. I'll always maintain that What's Opera Doc, also known as The Kill the Wabbit, that's one of the great films of all time, short
well,
films.
Well, you know, oh, darn it, the director, shoot. Taxi Driver. Come on.
Oh, Scorsese.
Yeah. I think it's Scorsese who says that One Froggy Evening is one of the great and most perfect films ever made. You know, Michigan J. Frog?
Oh, absolutely. Everybody loves a Michigan rag. Yeah. It's poetry. Think of what that's exploring about humanity and showing just the power of human faith and greed. greed-based faith.
Yeah.
But it's beautiful. And we've all been that person who finds that one thing that we think is beautiful and could make us powerful and wonderful and loved, and we just can't sell it to anybody else. We just can't get anybody else to identify.
A Bugs Bunny line that has, and I don't remember the name of the cartoon, and my life is nothing but a whole bunch of Bugs Bunny lines. That far down the rabbit hole. See what I did there, rabbit hole. But it has obtained a new relevance. This one particular episode, there's a short where Elmer J. Fudd is a millionaire. My name is Elmer J. Fudd, millionaire. Yes. I own a mansion and a yacht. And
yes,
and he's going crazy. And eventually, he swaps with Bugs Bunny and thinks he's a rabbit. And in the context of all the looming legal problems for the nitwit Nero, or COVID Caligula, as I like to call him also. Yes. In light of all of his looming legal problems, the last line of that cartoon where he's wearing the obviously stupid rabbit suit, and he turns to the camera and says, "I may be a squooey wabbit, but I'm not going to Alcatraz." Because they've just discovered that he owes massive amounts of money and all of that. But now he gets away with it. And he goes off and it's shot from behind him as he hops away into the distance doing to the music of the bunny hop. I may be a squooey wabbit, but I'm not going to Alcatraz. And the fact that his middle issue is J, just like, you know... My name is Donald J. Trump. I own a mansion and a yacht. You know, that's been his entire life.
You know, that was an impression of Alec Baldwin doing Trump.
Yes, it was.
It's sort of like the way that – I forget the fellow who did a really great Ed Sullivan, the really big shoe. You know,
and then everybody did him doing that. Yeah.
He really didn't talk like that, but like people who still remember doing an impression of Ed Sullivan. And they were really doing that other guy. They were doing the impression of an impression.
Yeah.
And that's what you just did.
Well, it is. And it's like I've said in the past, Ferg, my son, picked up some of my vocal abilities. And I get shit every time I mention this. Somebody will write in and say, leave Bubbles alone. But to do a good Donald Trump, it's a cross between... Carl, the assistant greenskeeper in Caddyshack, and Bubbles from Trailer Park Boys. If you can do that, you've got Trump.
I know that I don't know.
Well, okay, next after Bugs Bunny, but I want it because this is pressing. Well, I mean,
want to know. The people want to know.
Yes.
Number two, I have Scooby-Doo. I just think Scooby-Doo is, you want to talk. Versatility. I mean, Scooby-Doo has been through the Laugh Olympics. I love the All-Star Mystery Movies. Do you remember those?
Yes.
They'd be like,
yes.
Hey, isn't that Don Knotts? You know,
right?
Sandy Duncan just happens to Jerry Reed is doing a show, big show tonight, and we love all these things. I love that. I love those things. But Scooby-Doo could plug them into anything, and it's always the same thing. It's like Law and Order. It's like the cartoon version of Law and Order. It's the same structure.
That's perfect.
It resolves the exact same way. It's not really a ghost, kids. Don't worry. Don't be scared. It's just mean old Mr. Grump It was trying to scare people away from the amusement park because there was a buried treasure. You know, it's always the same.
I would have gotten away with it, too.
So sad. With meddling kids. And you know, they still make Scooby-Doos now. I forget what the new version is now. But, you know, they made them in the 70s. They made them in the 80s. In the 90s, my kids would watch some new version. And they would start to actually sort of like be retro about it. Or what is the word? Meta about it. Where it'd be like, well, it's time for us to be the meddling kids again. Like, they started to make fun of that. Number three for me was actually, it's a little controversial, I guess, Fat Albert and the Cosby Kids. I loved that show. Now, Cosby, I know. I won't watch the 80s show now, but the fact of the matter is I loved that show in the 1970s. And yeah, you had a little fun and you learned a little too, laughing with each other while you do your thing. Like that, Speed Racer was my number four.
Wow. Okay.
Well, I'll tell you the thing about Speed Racer. I loved all those early Japanese animations. I actually played like Kimba, the White Lion, more than I did Speed Racer. But Speed Racer blew my little five-year-old mind because I remember watching it, and there was an episode where somebody on the racetrack crashes, and you hear like a, "Arr!" And then, like, nobody gets out. You just see this car and catch on fire. And nobody gets out. So you're inferring that somebody died. And Kimba was the same way. It's like animals
pretty
would
heady.
Die.
Yeah, it's Kimba. Pretty heady stuff for Saturday morning.
Yeah. I think it was actually Sunday for us. In the Pittsburgh area, we had this Sunday morning show called Paul Shannon's Adventure Time. Your listener, who is a Pittsburgh fellow, might remember that one. And, yes, I very much remember the 1992 playoffs against the Braves with Bobby Bonilla sitting I think it was Barry Bonds just sitting down in the middle of the grass after the game crying because it was his last game as a Pirate and they lost. But it's in that Speed Racer's like one of those ones, if I watch it now, it's like, really? But at the time, boy, I just hadn't seen anything. I hadn't seen death on a Saturday morning or Sunday morning show, in this case, in Adventure Time. Land of the Lost, number five. Marshall Wilden.
And the greatest earthquake ever known. Yes.
And listen, I'm not saying these are the greatest shows ever made. I'm not even saying...
No, but they were engaging for a kid in the 70s whiling away his Saturday morning.
But when you're a kid... Yeah. It's the same way. Like, it's a great movie. I've seen it probably a dozen times. But the fact of the matter is it one of my favorite movies? It isn't. Not really. You know, I mean, I'd much rather see Singing in the Rain. I'd much rather see Night of the Living Dead. Because those movies had impact on me. And much as I love Citizen Kane, and I legitimately love it, but I'm watching it the way you were kind of talking about earlier. I watched that movie and I'm going like, oh, that shot's really incredible. And how clever that they did this and that Wells did this and that. He was only 27 and should have won the Oscar, which he should have. But it's not the same as like what Land of the Lost did for me was like, this is great. You know, lizard people.
Sleestacks.
You know,
Ron Howard's brother.
Yeah. That was Ron Howard's brother. It was
Clint. Wasn't Clint in it?
No, Clint was older than Ron. So by that point, he'd gone through General Ben, and he started to get ugly. He was a cute kid. We're talking Clint Howard here. Clint was in, he wasn't in Phantasm, but he was in some movie like that, where it's like, it was like late 70s, and you're like, Ron somehow became like the hottie of the family. But loved Land of the Lost. H.R. Puffin stuff, you got to give it up for that. I mean, if you're going to go Sid and Marty Krofft, you go with that. One cool thing about being in Facebook is that I am now Facebook friends with the only female member of the Bugaloos. And that's pretty cool. You're like, happy birthday. And she writes back, thanks. It's like, wow. I talked to like the coolest girl in school. And she said, thanks. You know, that's kind of what that was like. But H.R. Puffin stuff, you know. Have you ever seen the Mr. Show take off on H.R. Puffin stuff?
Oh, no, if there is one, I have to find it now.
Yeah, just put in Mr. Show H.R. Puffin stuff in YouTube. It's called something like the something of Drugachusetts, and the whole thing is like making the overt drug references real. Like the flute, Freddie the Flute, is a bong in his pocket. and people are like, one of the characters takes too much acid and starts to freak out. It's amazing. And they get real paranoid after smoking pot and they're too afraid to call for a pizza because they're afraid the cops are going to find them or something. It's pretty genius. That was, Mr. Show with, the Better Call Saul guy and the other guy.
Yep.
Bullwinkle and Rocky. I love You know what I love as much as Bullwinkle and Rocky is the show within the show, the Fractured Fairy Tales.
Oh, yeah.
Because I love Edward Everett Horton, character actor. He was in all these 1930s screwball romantic comedies, like Holiday and things like that. And he narrates it. He's the one going, once upon a time, there was a little girl. And it's just the way he says it. And it's just the humor. I mean, it's just like, again, when you're a kid and you're seeing like, and Rapunzel, was actually a rude little brat who didn't deserve love. And you're like, whoa, what is that? And Rocky and Bullwinkle, hey, Rocky, watch me pull a rabbit out of my hat.
Again?
This time for sure.
Yeah, and you said you don't do impressions.
Yeah, anybody can do that. Even I can do that. And I suck in impressions. Number eight, I have Pee-wee's Playhouse. Because that was a show that I watched in my 20s. And I don't think that came out until the late 80s. So I was probably either in college at the time.
There was genius to that. Now, you and I are about a year's different. Where did you fall on Captain Kangaroo?
I always watched it. And I did, Mr. Moose, when ping pong balls are falling, I'm a happy moose, Mr. Green Jeans. But that and Mr. Rogers always felt a little too gentle for my raucous 6 and 7 year old sensibilities. Maybe when I was 3, I was into more. I watched it though. It was always, but those were on weekdays, weren't they?
That wasn't Saturday. That was Monday through Friday. Well, okay. So let me ask you this. I mean, Agnes and I were raising children during the era of Barney the Dinosaur.
Mm-hmm.
Because Barney's definitely a love him or hate him kind of thing.
I get Barney. My kids were, by the time my kids came along, the Barney craze had passed, but you could still go into a Toys R Us and there were tons and tons of Barney toys. And my kids kind of like Barney, but I kind of raised my kids to be cynical anyway from a pretty early age, to laugh at what was stupid or when their intelligences were being underestimated, to point out that to them so that they would feel kind of cool that they got something that maybe their little friends hadn't. But here's where I feel about Barney. Here's what changed my mind about Barney. And I've probably told this story at least once on your show, but I love telling it. I was anti-Barney until one day I was in a Toys R Us with my kids. And, we used to just take the kids to Toys R Us and just let them run around for 2 hours. That was 2 hours of time. I didn't have to really do a whole lot. Just let the kids go in and look at Barbies and get on little scooters and stuff. And I'd get out of there at paying, for an $8 G.I. Joe or something. But anyway, I was wandering around Toys R Us and I saw a kid with a Barney. Like he had taken a Barney doll off the shelf and he was holding it and he was pressing it, the button. And little Barney, the little stuffed Barney was going, I think you're just great. Or, would you be my friend? Or, of course, the classic, I love you. And the kid was doing that over and over. And suddenly his mom came up to him and goes, what are you doing? Put that back. Don't be stupid. Don't make us pay for that. Da, 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 da. And like gives the kid a little smack on the arm or whatever and drags him away. And it's like, that kid needed Barney. Like if ever a kid needed Barney, that kid did. Because, I'm going to just wildly speculate that when that kid got home, he didn't hear a whole lot of, I love you, you're just great the way you are. He probably kept hearing that shit of, put away your laundry, your room's a pigsty, don't be so stupid, etc. Sometimes you just need that. Same with Mr. Rogers. When I was a kid, I didn't get Mr. Rogers. I was like, he's a baby. It's for babies. Now that I'm 56 years old, I'll go online, I'll watch a Mr. Rogers. Because it's like, I want to hear that. We're in a shit show of a world. I want to hear some reaffirmation that humanity is worth saving. And Fred Rogers, certainly, if nobody else could sell you on that, Fred Rogers could.
Damn
and
straight.
So could Bob Keeshan.
Yeah, to a certain extent.
As Captain Kangaroo. Bob Keeshan's thing, what I remember is it was a show that said, hey kids, let's be silly. You know, let's drop ping pong balls on Captain Kangaroo's head. But let's have Mr. Green Jeans, you know, sit on a pie. You know, so it was that kind of stuff. And so it was sort of like how the Three Stooges taught you to be silly, only of course in a much more safe environment.
And with less animosity.
Less animosity. Nobody called each other dumb or any of that kind of stuff. Now, my number nine spot is politically incorrect. I'm going to dare say it. I loved, and you might have been too old for this one, Hong Kong Phooey in 1976 or 77. Do you remember that one at all? It was a cartoon.
Yeah, oh, yes, I do. I do. And I also remember Go-Go Gadget.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I loved it, I think, partly because Scatman Crothers did the voice of Hong Kong Phooey. And yep. I don't know, it was just physical comedy, you know, and it was making fun of that 1970s kung fu craze. And I'm sure if I saw it now, I'd be like, well, that's an incredible amount of appropriation, you know, for children's television. But at the time, you know, it's a dog, and he's not, at least he isn't doing the stupid, you know, Chinese accent or, you know, buck teeth or anything. So it could have been worse, I guess. But I liked it. And Beanie and Cecil is my number 10. That might have been the very first cartoon I remember watching regularly. It was Beanie and Cecil, a Bob Clampett cartoon.
You know,
you remember that, right?
No, I don't. I need to check that out. There's one that I remember seeing early on in either the late 60s or early 70s that was really surreal. And I've looked for it in the past, and I can't even come up with anything close to a title to attach to it, but I remember just watching it with a sense of wonder. And I mean, it was zany, crazy, whatever. And I can't, but that's all I can remember. I mean, there were like, it was almost like Cubist, the animation was, you know, Picasso-esque. Now, I'm surprised the Pink Panther's nowhere on there.
I like the Pink Panther. You know what? I like the Ant and the Aardvark every bit as much as I like the Pink Panther.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you get two for the price of one with that.
Well, you know, too, the voices for the Ant and the Aardvark, John Byner provided both of those voices.
Yeah, John Byner doing Joey Bishop.
No. Oh, close. The Ant was the voice of Dean Martin. Hey there, Aardvark, what are you doing? You know, I'm sounding like Ed Norton. But he did Dean Martin for the Ant and Jackie Mason for
Jackie Mason was the Aardvark. Okay. I think I want a pizza. I think I want an Ant pizza.
Yeah. So it was Jackie Mason versus Dean Martin. And so, I don't know, I guess I like the dialogue of it. I watched the Pink Panther. I watched everything. You know, I had nothing to do. I lived in a hometown with 800 people.
And
750 people.
You only included one Sid and Marty Krofft, but where do you come down on Lidsville and Sheldon and the Sea Monsters and
Sigmund and the Sea Monsters?
Sigmund
and Sea Monsters. You know, I watched the Bugaloos mainly because I liked the girl. You know, I had a crush on the girl, Carolyn Ellis. Now my Facebook friend, bragging. And, you know, all of the Sid and Marty Krofts. I mean, the thing is, when you get a little bit older, then you start going like, I don't know, maybe I sort of grew out of it at a certain point. But no, that's not true. That's not true, Danny, because Sigmund and the Sea Monsters came in, I think, 76, 77, when Johnny Whitaker was just about a teen but still a kid. And I liked it. I didn't like the Rip Taylor thing when they had a genie on. All that stuff. I never like it when shows bring in magical genies. I didn't like The Great Gazoo and The Flintstones.
No. And you notice that was The Flintstones jumping the shark, Gazoo.
Yeah, Gazoo. You know, Harvey Korman. You know, dum-dum. But that and Rip Taylor as the genie on Sigmund. It's like, I don't want magical beings. I want real life problems that I can relate to from The Flintstones. Which is just a ripoff of
Speaking of which, did you ever, there was an early 70s feature, it ran on ABC, called The Point. Have you ever seen that?
Sure, yeah. That's with Harry Nilsson.
Yeah.
Great music.
Me and My Arrow.
Yeah. Me and my arrow. And there was a, yeah, I love that stuff. Oblio, story of Oblio, the boy with a round head. And it was, what's funny is that
narrated by Ringo Starr, wasn't it?
Well, originally, the first time it aired, and I watched it the first time it aired in like 1970 or 71, it was, and I didn't know this at the time, but it was Dustin Hoffman. And then for whatever reason, after that, they replaced the narration with Ringo Starr for the subsequent repeats, and then went over. You know something? It's 8 o'clock now. I don't know your thoughts. This is a thought I have. You want to hear it?
Yes.
Would you be willing to have me on tomorrow to make this a two-parter?
I wouldn't have any problem doing that whatsoever. We need the break.
Yeah, I think so, but I'll tell you this much. In your
well, I want to get into your list of notable West Virginians, and I want to get past G.
Should we? Well, we could either go overtime tonight, or we could save it for tomorrow night. Up to you.
Which one's easier for you?
Let's save it, because you know I could just go through a list, but you know me, I like commenting. I like little
right. It's little all about the conversation.
Brag when I've met people, you know, I got no problem with that. So let's do it again 6 to 8 tomorrow night. But my only caveat is this, and I promise you this. If something really of consequence happens tomorrow, if somebody important gets assassinated or Trump suddenly outlaws, you know,
breathing,
anybody, you know, outlaws democracy for real, like just says the quiet part loud, I never want to feel like I'm coming on like, hey, let's talk about cartoons when like real honest God shit is coming down. I, you know, the same with like.
But you know what, Dan? At this point in time, with the entire country vibrating like a 440A tuning fork, I think I think this business of stepping back is important, and just and I can tell from the responses that I'm getting from the community. I just got a reference here from Jack in Shreveport. Saturday morning, quick draw McGraw. Hong Kong Phooey reminded me of El Kabong. Maybe Phooey sounded like Baba Louie of Quick Draw McGraw. I don't know. Shorty in L.A. says, the stuttering Aunt Hagatha cracked me up.
What's Aunt?
Aunt Hagatha. I'm trying to... she sounds like she might be a witch of some sort, but I don't recall that one.
I don't think that's the one in the Warner Brothers, though, because I don't think that witch...
And Ron in Raleigh points out, now this wasn't a Saturday morning thing, but I guess it was in syndication, but Ron in Raleigh points out, I haven't heard anyone mention the original Muppet Show.
Well, that's something we can get into tomorrow, because we have a whole slew of movies and TV and lists that I've made, because I'm a list maniac, that we could get into that a bit tomorrow, a little comparative favorites, let's say you and me. And Muppet Show is definitely on one of my favorites. I'll put it that way.
Okay. Well, I think we should have at it again. We've never done it. We've never done a two-part Super Friends Dan and Bob conversation one night after another.
Twins, activate.
Exactly.
Although you and I would never be mistaken for twins, I don't think.
We're
both white, both relatively tall. You're taller than me. Let me share, before we go, here's some trivia for you too, because if our friend was talking about the witch from the Looney Tunes, whose name I think was Broomhilda.
Yes.
The woman that did the voice for that, the cackling witch on those, also did the voice for Rocky J. Squirrel.
Oh, yes.
Voice artist June Foray.
Yes, I think it was Chuck Jones who once said, no, June Foray is not the Mel Blanc of female voiceovers. Mel Blanc is the June Foray. She was that. Oh, and Aunt Agatha. Okay, Aunt Agatha, that was Bewitched. Yes, the doddering old auntie witch.
Hermione Gingold?
Was it Hermione Gingold?
I think so.
And in confirmation of what you what we were talking about, Matt in San Francisco says today's conversation has been refreshing, like cleaning the palate between tastings.
Very elegant. Say it in a British accent, you'll really sound classy.
It's been refreshing, like cleansing the palate between tastings.
Yes. Pardon me, do you have any Grey Poupon?
You're not one of them Kenyan Muslim you slurper presidents, are you?
Remember when he got in?
Barack Obama. He ain't one. That Barack Obama. He ain't one of them man of the people type. He eats that fancy gray poo poo mustard.
Oh, and right. We've been corrected on Warner Brothers. Witch Hazel on Bugs Bunny. It was Witch Hazel.
Witch Hazel. Oh, that was Broomhilda. Oh, Broomhilda was of course the Sunday morning comic.
Yes,
that was Broomhilda.
Yeah. And she got animated at some point too, and you know great moments in mid 20th century sexism. The episode where where Bugs is trying to flee from Witch Hazel, and finds in case of emergency break glass, and there's a potion in it, and he breaks it at Witch Hazel's feet. And she turns into this mega hottie girl bunny.
Oh, that, yeah.
And they walk away into the sunset with the little hearts bursting all around them. And then at the end, or toward the end, Bugs looks over his shoulder, breaks the fourth wall, and says, "Yeah, I know, but aren't they all deep down inside?"
Oh, Bugs. Me too, Bugs.
Yep. Me too, Bugs.
Characters, you're not gonna hear a lot of casting couch stories and so forth. You know, Bugs Bunny will never be a Danny Masterson.
Although you know, if there was a Roger Rabbit too, God, there might be. No. Oh, let's just leave that be.
Yeah, it's 86, and I never want to get you in trouble with the Warren folks.
Oh no! I go overtime all the time, but it's been a delightful conversation, Dan, and it always is.
It's fun, and what's important to me? It's super important to me that your listeners seem to have fun with it. That you know, I know it's self indulgent of me to do this stuff, but I'm glad that you like it. So I'm happy to do it again tomorrow.
And make no mistake, I mean I do this stuff. I mean not this stuff, not what you and I are doing. But, you know, just little random observations from my boring little life, mentioning things along the way that, you know, happened to me out in the naked mountains. You know, there's 1,000 stories in the naked mountains. I found something today, as a matter of fact. Everyone knows that I sing the glories of pickle juice. And now, lo and behold, the world has caught up with me. Now there is actually a company in, Mesquite, Texas. The Pickle Juice Company, LLC. And they're doing little shot bottles of pickle juice as stamped USDA organic. Purpose-built formula, the functional evolution of pickle brine. Extra strength pickle juice shot. Functional organic beverage. Shake well and drink prior to or during exercise to prevent muscle cramps, or at the onset to stop exercise-induced or nighttime cramps. You know, I was maybe 14 years old, coming home from freshman year football practice. It was just before Gatorade came out, and my mother would have an ice-cold can of Kraut juice in the refrigerator for me. This is Alabama in August. You know, it's a million degrees Fahrenheit with 103% humidity. And nothing ever tasted better than that ice cold Kraut juice did.
Ugh. You say so.
And so here we are. And
I was a Kool-Aid man myself after those high school band practices.
Well, it's got electrolytes. It's what plants crave.
Oh, yeah.
And so we have an Idiocracy reference to end the program.
What are electrolytes then? I mean, what do you think electrolytes actually do? Well, they're just electrolytes.
It's what plants crave.
It was up on his grave. That was a really, that was good.
So you did, you've gotten around, and that's the thing, Galaxy Quest and Idiocracy both beg multiple viewings.
I think so. It's they're both very clever movies, and two, they're you know, they're comedies in this current era, more or less. I mean, you know, at least, I don't know how old they are, but they're comedies that aren't just like Fatty Fall Down, Go Boom, you know, or, you know, Drunk Guy Runs Out and He Forgot His Pants. There's more going on than that. That's what I said before. I like entertainment. I like stupid, fun entertainment, but not really stupid. I like fun, but give me something I haven't thought of. Show me something I haven't seen. Entertain me, I say.
Are you not entertained?
Dost thou not be entertained? Yeah. Where's that? Who said that? Are you not entertained?
That's Gladiator, yeah.
Okay, I like that movie. Love it. I didn't think it was the best picture, but, you know, I know people love that movie. Braveheart, you know, same stuff. Anyway, it's just feeling like maybe it's that time for me to, you know, pick up my top hat and my cane and start that, you know, little shuffle off the side.
Oh, we're the boys of the chorus. We hope you like the show. We know you're rooting for us, but now we have to go.
Oh, that's a poetic way to go. Okay, so I'm going to come back tomorrow.
And say hello to the lovely Helene for us, please.
I will. I plan to come back. I know it's valuable to have good laughs and stuff. If there's a crisis and it seems not appropriate, I won't. But otherwise, you'll hear from me at 6.
Very good. I'll be here.
Okay?
All right. Book 'em, Dano. Okay. Murder One.
I wish I had a funny exit line. I don't, but I will tomorrow.
I've been waiting for years to tell somebody named Dan to book him Dano. I mean, come on.
That's funny. That's funny enough. That's clever.
Aloha.
I'm going.
All right.
Goodbye. Thank you, your listeners, for contributing to the show. And come back tomorrow and keep trying to pump me with questions that I'll probably get wrong.
Yeah,
Rich Little is not dead.
Yes, and John Biner.
John Biner.
And I hope
John Biner than Rich Little.
Yeah, I hope we haven't jinxed either one of them in the middle of the pandemic by mentioning them.
Well, you certainly talked a lot about Rush Limbaugh tonight before I came on, so maybe that'll work on him. It's not nice to say that, but I'm thinking it, so I might as well say it.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it's not like he's a national treasure. At least not in my eyes. But anyway, plenty of people think that about me. So, you know, root hog or die, tough hide lasts the longest, as they say.
Oh, everybody loves Bob. Everybody, and you're the second runner up.
Second runner up. I mean, there were 10 of us. Yeah. I'm in the top 70%, 30%, 30%. I can't cipher.
Average.
Yes,
but 7.
Nothing says broadcast adequacy like being the second runner up.
7 people in West Virginia who are less well regarded than you.
Yes.
So there you go.
Yeah.
Ha ha ha.
And by the way, Brother Deacon Asa said, "Damn, Bob, congratulations. I did not doubt your adequacivity for a moment. In the words of the late great Bill McNeil, you're adequate and workhorse like." Bill McNeil.
Journey.
News Radio.
There you go. Oh, that's right there.
Yeah. All right, Dan.
I'm going.
We're going.
Good night, Chris.
Good night, George. Our buddy Dan Fisher. There's nothing like a conversation with Dan. I cherish them, you know, each and every one of them. And I know, and y'all do too, from what you tell me. It's a blast. And he's got a lot more stuff to go into. That's why we're going to do a Super Friends edition and do 2 more hours tomorrow night. And like I said, I want to know about those 39 notable West Virginians. And I wonder if Charles Manson's on the list. It always seems he is. But thank you, Dan. And thanks to all of you who keep this program on the air. Thanks again to James. Thank you very kindly for the have a show and 2.5 shows on me. That's a huge help with bills that are desperately needing paid right damn now. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you to all of you who subscribe either Patreon or PayPal and are partial sponsors of the program. Thanks to all of you who jump in a la carte and partially sponsor the program so that there are no ads and no hustles for sketchy homeopathic remedies or gadgets or the gym cracks that, well, you get the idea. Thank you. And thanks to all of you who share your precious finite time engaging in the program in whatever manner you so choose. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to Sparky and Steve in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, HeadOn.live. Here in about, 45 minutes, brand new episode of Malloy on the way, 9 o'clock, HeadOn.live, the best place to listen to the Malloy program. Thanks, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. 20 plus years at the forefront of the struggle for human rights and environmental justice in Appalachia. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Please be safe. Stay home if you can. Stay away from mass gatherings. You know the drill. Wear your mask. Wear your gloves. Wash your hands. Don't touch your face. Keep some hand sanitizer on at hand or nearby at all times. Maintain your social distance. Make it make your breadth 20 feet, Mr. Spock. And by all means, if somebody comes up to you saying, if you see somebody saying, I believe in the Barrington Declaration, me and Dr. I.P. Freely, avoid that person like the plague, because he is. Later, y'all.